settling in at the top of the sideshow. That's Avenged Sevenfold, or known to us on the inside,
AV7.
Welcome to the family. That does it for us for today. We'll be back next week with more of the biggest songs in rock, plus handpicked songs by me for you. I'm Nikki Sixx.
I'm Carrie Kasem.
And we'll see you next weekend on the Sideshow Countdown.
The Sideshow is now over. Go ahead, stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
Now.
Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. Hi, Jolene.
Hello, Peter.
You were down at Autorama, huh?
I had a long day. My voice is a little raspy.
Husky.
Talking to the people, you know?
Autorama, by the way, folks, is not to be confused with the Detroit International Auto Show, where everybody is in tuxedos and gowns.
This is
and
the opposite, and it is fun.
It is custom cars.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And it was great to see quite a few Night Call listeners.
Yeah, that's great.
Who found me and said, hey.
Yeah. Well, welcome to the broadcast. This is a phone-in talk show, and our numbers are 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
If you'd like to email us when the lines are busy, which they are not now. No.
They are not.
They are not now. You can email us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. That's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. We have a Facebook page.
We sure do.
You know how to do it. Look for Night Call.
Yes,
and you got it. We have a new discussion page as well. And we have a brand new photograph, both on there and on my website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com. And
it only took us 3 years.
Well, yeah. And
how it goes here.
We came out looking pretty good.
Well, yes.
You look as pretty as you are,
Peter.
I came out much, much, much more better looking than I am. Go ahead. Give me the compliment. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Here's what everyone said. Why does that damn Werby never age?
Well, it's
because he's liberal.
Yeah, well, no, it's because Photoshop.
No, it's not. There was no Photoshop.
I know.
Did you Photoshop that thing?
No.
You better not have. I'm like, I better look that good.
No, you did. Everybody's worried about themselves. You know, I actually just sent out a photograph of a bunch of my wife's friends. There was like 15 women, and every woman who saw it commented on what? Themselves.
Yes, of course.
Right.
It's how we go.
Yeah, no doubt. We'll have a podcast available at noon on Monday if you'd like to hear this show in podcast. And you can subscribe to it for free. Aaron, thank you so much for doing it.
Yes.
And Jeremy, if you're listening. And as always, Jade, thank you for having set things up. And
It takes more than just us.
It takes a village. Well, you know, there was a, I just looked this up. There was a song in 1966 called, what's the name of it? I know. Wait a minute here. Give the phone numbers again or something.
313-298-9743. I see someone's already ready to call.
Yeah, no, it's what the hell's the name of it? The Eastern World. It is exploding. Eve of Destruction.
Okay, good. You know, and whenever someone puts you on the spot like that, then you can't remember.
Yeah, no, but we're on the opposite. In fact, let me see. Maybe we can even do this again to start off our discussion here. Yeah. Right. Well, both.
Now
we took that off because these teabaggers had kind of co-opted that whole sense of revolution and standing up to the government and what have you.
But we got a crazy train.
Yeah.
Right?
All aboard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And now the people have reclaimed that slogan that began in the 1960s, power to the people, the sense of revolution of, but in this case, what's happening? Well, there's two aspects to it. One is international, and that's a real revolution. They
Amazing.
Are turning over these horrid dictatorships, these sheikdoms and all that, that have repressed and oppressed people for so long.
Which, you know what, Ted Rall. At,
Ted Rall, R-A-L-L, TedRall.com.
He said, see, people, Saddam would have been toppled regardless. We're another stupid
Saddam Hussein,
there.
That
it was going to happen.
Couldn't have been, hadn't to be these hundreds of thousands of casualties, American and Iraqi.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, well.
In the name of a lie.
In the name of a lie, right. So, and here, though, the class war that was declared 30 years ago on the middle class and the working class by the ultra wealthy, and that's been put into full force by the Republicans and sometimes a little help from the Democrats, has finally been met with a challenge. And it's really not revolution that's happening in Madison. They're militant. They're angry and very peaceful, though. And they're just not standing for it anymore. And essentially, they're fighting for the status quo, if you think about that.
Yes.
Yeah. They're not saying, hey, we want more. In fact, the unions that are representing the public workers in Wisconsin, they're saying we're willing to give financial concessions, which I think, by the way, is a terrible mistake and they shouldn't do it. There is no debt. Well, there is. I mean, formally, there's a deficit. I mean, the states, the nation are.
But it's not what it's not the answer to. I mean, it's a deficit. Who doesn't have a deficit?
Yeah. And there doesn't have to be. You remember 10 years ago before Bush took over and ruined everything.
Yeah.
There was a surplus, in fact. But what happened? If you fight wars that don't need to be fought, if you cut taxes for the wealthy, if you continue to allow tax breaks for corporations, you give companies like ExxonMobil the privilege of almost paying no tax whatsoever. Well, you wind up in a situation like this. And I started the show last week like this. I said, something's wrong here. We have the wealthiest country in the world. In other words, there is the most wealth parked in this country, owned by individuals, by corporations, by financial institutions. And the country's broke and the states are broke. But the ultra-wealthy aren't. So
doing just fine.
Yeah. So there was a wealth shift. That is to say, the wealth from individuals and from the average person and from the states and even from the federal government lost wealth while the ultra wealthy gained wealth. So that's class war. They declared class war on us and they won. They kicked our ass.
Yeah, they sure did.
Because look what's happened to us. We've got 10% unemployment. They are paying themselves, like on Wall Street, $150,000 bonuses on average. Some of them are getting $1 million. The criminals that created the problem are rewarding themselves greatly. I found out that I watch MSNBC every once in a while, The Ed Show, and
Rachel Maddow.
Thank you. And then I found out that that station, that wacky station, Fox News, is right above it on Comcast. So I've been looking at it, and I'm going, and I'm speechless every time I turn it on. They had a woman on tonight that was justifying the Wall Street bonuses.
Oh,
they deserve it.
Really?
Yeah.
That's not surprising.
Oh, well, I mean,
but it's still appalling.
That they would have the nerve to actually come out and say, this is okay. That the people that created the problem, that has created the cause of the destruction and the misery, the financial ruin, the emotional turmoil that has just laid so many people low, that, okay, it's all right if they get it. You know what? They should get nothing. In fact, they're really, since they've declared class war, they've won. Now we're starting to hold the line. You're saying, well, wait a minute. Now, you're not going to just, send us totally into peasantry. So we're fighting back finally. And yet we got to start going the other way. Once we see the power of the people, power to the people, the power of the people, we can start making those gains that we need to. And we can start paying off those deficits on the backs of the people that can afford it. We can't. Now,
And meanwhile, you know, of course, we have all heard us talking about the middle class shrinking. The middle class is going after each other now. There's infighting where there wasn't as much before.
What do you mean?
In that people who are in the middle class are worshiping these fat cats and supporting them.
Yeah, I mean, you're right.
I think the teabaggers, mostly in a lot of these baggers.
Think about this. Well, maybe it's time even to talk about this. There were labor protests across the country in all 50 states coordinated yesterday. Hundreds of thousands of people, 150,000 people alone. According to the rally organizers in Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah, it was huge.
You think that's exaggerated? Okay. The Associated Press or somebody like that said there was 70 to 90,000. All right, we'll lowball it, all right? But still, people turned out in incredible numbers. And you know what? The teabaggers, when they were getting such play in the media, it's almost like they don't even exist anymore. They are so rapidly
on the decline.
Yeah, all the ratings of these TV shows and radio shows of all these nut job teabaggers and teabag supporters and all that.
And what did Glenn Beck apologize? I already apologized for.
He made some
like
stupid remark about rabbis being like Islamic terrorists or something. I saw him really for almost the first time, and my jaw dropped.
I know
this guy. What a piece of work!
Oh, he really is.
And some people say he's an entertainer. He really. I can see that maniacal look in his.
Oh, yeah.
This fruitcake really believes it. He had this thing on. I usually don't. I mean, given that the fact that he's dropped off, I think his ratings have dropped off 37%. If our ratings dropped off 37%, we would be out of here.
Yeah, that's right.
He was saying that President Obama had never mentioned Gaddafi by name. And so he looks at you like. You know,
he's so full of it.
Well, he has now, but I don't think he had. So then he brings back up this Reverend Jeremiah Wright.
He's digging deep.
This was Obama's minister, and this guy was pretty rad. Actually, most of what he said was correct, I thought. He said some stupid things, but, you know, everybody does. Except for me and Jaleen.
Never.
Anyway, so here's the connection. So Reverend Jeremiah Wright somehow is connected with Minister Farrakhan.
Oh, okay.
And Farrakhan had gone to Libya in the middle 90s or something like that and met Gaddafi.
Okay.
So you get it?
No.
Neither did I.
Oh. I'm so glad you didn't either.
Yeah, yeah. All right, enough of that. So anyway, when the teabaggers were bringing out like 1,000 people to these rallies, 1,500 people, they were all over the news. I got to say, you know, these demonstrations.
Which we're saying that's not a lot compared to what we're seeing here.
Yeah, 100 and, all right, I'm willing to lowball it. 70, 90,000,
okay.
Maybe 150,000. Also, what happened was that the governor of Scott Walker of Wisconsin. Said, you have to leave. He said this to the protesters who've been occupying the Capitol.
That was today.
For 2 weeks. Today, he said, you got to leave.
And this is important because the cops stood behind.
Yeah, there were police.
You can spend the night in the Capitol.
But there were police who were actually part of the occupiers.
Yeah, right, right. I saw a picture of that. And
one of the things in this bill to strip labor of its organizing rights, its collective bargaining rights, rather, was that the police and fire unions were exempt for this because they would retain their collective bargaining rights. So on the face of it, it's unconstitutional, this law that they're trying to pass. It doesn't meet constitutional muster to have equal protection under the law. Anyway, so the occupation of the Wisconsin Capitol by protesters was declared at an end. 4 p.m., they said they had to clean it. Now, it was being cleaned regularly by the demonstrators who were living there. And you say, wait a minute, man, that's not usual. That's not normal. You know what? It's not, because these are not usual or normal times.
That's true.
This tool... This governor, who is a tool, a stooge for his paymasters, the Koch brothers, is using extraordinary measures to destroy the standard of living of average people.
He's one bad apple.
He is.
Amongst the many others.
Among many bad apples. So the cops told him, you've got to get out of there by 4 p.m. Central Time. And then after 3 hours, they said, okay, you can stay. So that's good.
Yeah, that was really cool.
Yeah, let's see.
And I know that you said that some of the crowd is dispersed, but they'll be back tomorrow. This is not ending.
Yeah. There was a couple thousand people in Lansing yesterday.
Right.
Mayor of Lansing, Virge Bonaro, who was the gubernatorial candidate for...
I still have his sign in my backyard.
Yeah. It'd be great if he would have won. Yeah. But
he never would have talked about those film incentives.
Hey, by the way, 313-298-WRIF, if you have an opinion on any of this, like to hear from you. Ooh, I'm going to have some problems here because I don't even have my little screen up.
You want me to get it for you up there, Peter?
No, I can do it.
Okay.
I think. Whoa.
Man. I know the multitasking thing.
Yeah, I can do it. give the phone numbers or something like that.
Well, I'm wondering what's going on with the Oscars. I know a couple of things happened. Someone who won thanked their union crew.
Yeah, I heard that.
And the other, the other thing that happened.
Melissa Leo,
yeah, who I never even knew who she was before that, but she threw.
Dropped the F-bomb.
Dropped the F-bomb. And, there was someone else who said something about why haven't these Wall Street criminals been put in jail or something like that.
Whoa. All right. You know, I got to do now. I got to make this test. Okay, we're ready to go.
Yeah. Ready to rock.
Yeah, ready to rock. 313-298-WRIF. That'll get you on the air. But you were talking. You got to remember, the quintessential sophomoric question. Ooh, it is, what is reality, right?
Yes, sure.
And the other thing, I connect that to what I always say, power is the ability to define reality or phenomena, right? If you can get people to see the world through your lens, then it comes out that's reality.
Yes, sure.
So how do people actually feel about these unions? Something like 7% of people in the private sector belong to unions. So you think, well, this could be much ado about nothing, right? Because there's so few people. And so why are these crazed right-wingers and Republicans and teabaggers so hot to destroy these unions? And why do so many people support that? Well, people aren't buying into this Republican and right-wing crap, if you'll excuse me. According to USA Today, the poll they did, Americans strongly oppose laws taking away the collective bargaining power of public employee unions. According to a USA Gallup poll, the poll found 61% would oppose a law in their state similar to such a proposal in Wisconsin, compared to 33% who would favor such a law. 71% oppose increasing sales, income, or other taxes, while 27% are in favor. 53% oppose reducing pay or benefits for government workers. 48% oppose reducing or eliminating government programs. That's all pretty good. Republicans supported limiting bargaining by only 54-41. However, 82% of Democrats opposed limiting bargaining.
There was
like
one Republican that voted against it.
Oh, did he?
Tonight, yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Most Americans think the United States should raise taxes for the rich to balance the budget, according to a 60 Minutes Vanity Fair poll released a couple weeks ago or so. And that could be done. In fact, let me see. I got so many little things here. If there was simply a tax on Wall Street transactions, a small tax on every single Wall Street transaction.
Sure. Hey, that's a great idea.
The entire deficit for the country and the state would be blown away. Anybody oppose that, by the way? But here, let me tell you what's going on. Remember I was talking earlier about that there's this class war. Well, this was an article, Yahoo News. Separate but unequal charts show growing rich-poor gap. The Great Recession and the slump that followed have triggered a jobs crisis that has been making headlines since before President Obama was in office. Well, hello. I think it started under Bush.
Yeah.
And it'll be likely with us for years, which is terrible. Let's see. This chart, and it shows charts. You go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, and this chart and everything else there. This chart shows that the poorest 90% of Americans make an average of $31,000 a year. 90, the the poorest 90% is an odd way to say it. The,
yeah.
From, you know, the poorest up to the 90%. Tile, the average is 31%. Wow. The top 1% make over $1.1 million. In the last 30 years, the middle class wealth and income has remained absolutely static. The top 1% has had its wealth quadruple.
Man.
The last 30 years. What happened 30 years ago? Let me think. Is anything of any... What year was that? Let's do some math. 2011, 1981. What happened on January 20th, 1981? Ronald Reagan. So this is what we're looking at, folks. This is the strategy that the ultra-wealthy and their politicians who work on their behalf and these numbnuts, is that okay to say?
Yes.
that operate, you know, if as if though they were in the 1% rather than the bottom 90%, have brought about this attack. See, there was, there was this incredible fight during the 1930s, 1940s, and 50s that had to do with economic and social equality. Or not, you know, not that we're going to make everybody equal, but brought about the ability for people to not have to work 12 hours, to have a weekend, not have child labor laws, to regulate the environment, all this stuff like that. You know, so that they didn't get, we don't all get poisoned, which is starting to happen again. And then now the capitalist class, this small class of owners, have decided to come back at us again. They want their money. It's their economy. It's a capitalist economy. We're not capitalists. We're workers, right? I know, man, that sounds pretty rad and all that. But I mean, that's the economic facts of it. You can use any other language you want, but that's the simplest and most precise. How about this? The world's 225 richest men have a combined wealth of over $1 trillion. 225 men have a combined wealth of over $1 trillion, equal to the annual income of the poorest half of the world. In other words, 225 men have as much money, wealth, money, however you count it, as 3 billion of us. Globally, the richest fifth of humanity holds 85% of the world's wealth. The poorest fifth, 1.4%. The three richest men in the world have assets greater than the combined gross domestic product of the 48 poorest nations. 60 Americans have total assets of $331 billion.
My gosh.
The richest Microsoft chair, Bill Gates, owns $8 billion more than the assets of 104 million Americans. Goes on like this. Let's see. The richest 1% holds more than 40% of the nation's wealth, doubling their share in just 20 years. Middle-class Americans lost 10% of their wealth in the last 10 years. The income gap between the best and the worst-paid U.S. workers is now the most extreme of the 25 most industrialized nations, exceeding even economically lopsided societies like Guatemala. I mean, this goes just on and on and on. Let's see. You know what? I really screwed up.
What?
You know where these figures are from?
Don't admit it. What?
These are from 1999.
Wait.
And they've gotten worse, folks.
Yes, they have.
I found this in an old publication. Every one of these statistics have gotten worse, so that the rich have gotten richer and the poor have gotten poorer. Well, the choice becomes, and I don't know how else... and part of this, by the way, you can track this destruction of what what we began to win in the 1930s with the decline of unions. Because although unions never represented more than a third of the population, so two-thirds of the population was not, or workers rather, not of the population, two-thirds of the working population in the United States were never in unions. But they fought for and continue to fight for a standard of living, wages, benefits, protections, all of that for all workers. And, I mean, sometimes they haven't been real cool. And now, like the UAW under Bob King says, we don't have to have just a union movement. We have to have a social movement.
Yes.
Yeah. So you can track as the unions decline, so does everything that we fought for and now have lost over the last 30 years. And here you get the head of one of the U.S. biggest industrial groups saying that Barack Obama's attempts to repair relations with companies doesn't work for him. He says he's anti-business, which I'm not quite sure how he is. He said manufacturers could shift production out of the U.S. to Canada or Mexico as a result, warned George Buckley, chief executive and chairman of 3M. Last month, the president created a Jobs and Competitiveness Council, chaired by Jeffrey Immelt, chief executive of GE. That doesn't sound real, business unfriendly, does it?
No.
He says, politicians forget that business has choice. We're not indentured service, and we will do business where it's good and friendly. If it's hostile incrementally, things will slip away. We've got a real choice between manufacturing in Canada and Mexico, which tend to be pro-business, or America. This, folks, is blackmail.
Absolutely.
Pure and simple. All right, we'll be right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Getting across town to a job interview is stressful enough without being late. But the GPS on my cell phone guides me right where I need to be with no problems along the way. I want the same thing when I do my taxes. TurboTax has a unique GPS feature that guides me step by step, and calculations are guaranteed 100% accurate, so I know it's done right, which helps me reach my maximum refund, guaranteed.
Try it online now at TurboTax.com. Choose easy. Accurate calculation and maximum refund money-back guarantee details at TurboTax.com.
And now here's another tax tip from TurboTax. While college tuition costs can add up fast, the deductions and credits can add up too. That's because this year, the American Opportunity Credit for college tuition is up to $2,500. This amount is available for all 4 years of college and for each student in your family. It even covers the cost of books. To find out more about how TurboTax can help you get the maximum refund you deserve, visit us online at TurboTax.com.
Does your furnace need repair? Does your house need cleaning? Or maybe you're ready to update your kitchen. Big or small, whatever your home improvement need, log on to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. Service Magic is a free online resource with instant access to top-rated remodelers, maids, handymen, roofers, and many other home contractors. It's easy and it's free. Just go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. fixitfast.servicemagic.com. fixitfast.servicemagic.com.
Jeez, Q, it's hot as in here. What's going on?
Oh, it's only 91 degrees.
Where? In the refrigerator?
Ouch! The countertop is so hot you can fry eggs on it. And bacon and home fries. Are you on that sweat diet?
No.
I'm melting my life away.
Hey, by not running my air conditioner, I'm saving energy and helping the environment.
Uh-huh. There's an easier way to help the environment. Go green. Go public. Take public transportation. It's good for the environment, and you don't have to sweat it, if you know what I mean. So you got any eggs?
No.
How about shrimp? We can fry shrimp. Do you have any shrimp?
No. I have anchovies.
Mm-mm, no.
A message from the public transportation systems across the country. To learn more, visit publictransportation.org.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. I was trying to play something. Oh, maybe I can. Maybe I got to. Let's see.
Cue it back to the beginning. I meant to tell you that.
Thank you.
All right, that's Unionize, Union Fight Song, put together by Ratcliffe Bailey, and it's an MP3 that I got sent. You can go to westfieldrecording.com, westfieldrecording.com, or if you'd like a copy of it, I'll be glad to forward it to you. Just write us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And one of the things I think this is significant of is that when you start having a popular culture around social struggles, you know you're really starting to get somewhere.
Yes, making waves, or actually breaking through somehow.
Yeah.
Hey, at the Oscars, I was all excited about the documentary category, and the one you predicted, Inside Job, won for Best Documentary. That's the, it says here, a searing assault on the banking industry and its role in the financial meltdown. I've got to see that.
Yeah, and
did you see it?
No, I haven't seen it.
And Gasland was up for it, too, so I would have been happy with either one.
Absolutely.
And apparently what, Peter?
The what?
You said, and apparently, and I cut you off. Okay.
Who knows? Apparently, we should get to our phones. There's a couple open lines at 313-298-WRIF, and let's go to Mike in Clay Township. Hey, Mike, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, thanks. You were just talking about the union struggle out in Wisconsin, and actually you got it going right here in St. Clair County. The county's trying to take the ASME union and cut their insurance from a PPO-2 down to a PPO-8, which will effectively, for a lot of people, cut about 20 to 25% of their take-home pay that they're going to have to do medical now that they won't be able to do anything else with.
Yeah, and there's all this outsourcing going on because they realize that the wages that people have fought for now for, what is it, 3 or 4 generations, they can get them, they can get people to do those jobs for half that. And that looks always inviting to managers. I mean, the idea, again, let me say that when you have a county, when you have a municipality like Detroit, when you have a state like Michigan, when you have a government like the United States, there's a revenue problem. It's that they're not taking in enough money. But we have enough wealth in this country that we don't have to take it out on the backs of the average working person, to be sure, Mike.
Yeah. Well, the other interesting thing is they said that with benefit package, the average county worker makes $75,000 a year, but yet with benefit package, the average union worker for ASME probably is somewhere around
$45,000.
Wow. So, you know, that's a $30,000 average that their upper management's making that they want to take it away from the lower union people.
Well, sure. What is it? The governor of Wisconsin appointed, his father-in-law to be the... Or something like that.
It was the police chief?
Yeah, the state police chief to this job that pays like $105,000. You know? So, yeah, it's a racket. I mean, listen, we
use that word more than anything on the
show.
What,
a racket?
There's so much racketeering that going on.
I mean, it has to be faced. I mean, because, look, the unions in Wisconsin and probably a lot of other places, the Democrats in Washington said, look, we're willing to make some cuts. I think no cuts. What we got to do is increase revenue and mainly tax the rich. In fact, there ought to be an enormous tax on wealth, on accumulated wealth. So when you have, I forgot, I did the math last week. I don't know if I still have that here. When you have the 10th or the 10 richest people in the country that combine, yeah, they make $270 billion. That's enough to take care of all the state's budgets, for instance. So in other words, if we took $150 billion from these 10 people, they're the top wealthiest people, they would be left with $120 billion between them. I mean, could you live on that?
Oh, I think I can manage.
So they've declared class war on us. We don't do that in return. We're just trying to protect what we have, which is good. I mean, right now we have to do it. I don't mean that we ought to, you know, that there's some, I don't even know on what political basis we could begin an offensive, but, you know, they can afford it. We can't. They can afford to lose a class battle. We can't, right?
That's right, because we're not going to get it back.
Well, yeah, or I'll tell you what, if it gets taken away, if the unions get destroyed, something else will replace it down the line. But that'll mean us or our kids or our grandkids are going to have to go through the 1930s all over again, and we shouldn't have to do that. All right, Mike, fight it out there. It's, you know, every at every juncture, we got to say no. All right, thanks a lot. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. By the way, there was 2,000 people in, I did say, there was 2,000 people in Lansing yesterday.
Yes.
George Bonaro, the mayor of Lansing, who was the gubernatorial candidate for the Democrats there, was there and spoke. All, and an incredible speaker, actually. Here's Eric in Bellevue. Hey, Eric, you're on the air. Welcome. Eric, are you, well, I got, I mean, is this the thing where I got to push the button?
Yeah, that little thing.
Yeah, hey, Eric, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just had a quick comment. They just passed last week in Michigan, and it's going to the governor's desk. It gives emergency managers for cities and school systems ultimate power.
Right.
Used to have to go through binding arbitration to break police and fire unions.
Uh-huh.
And it now is they have basically all the power they want to do whatever they want with the contracts to balance the budgets of these cities. We all know there's a lot of cities in trouble. And, you know, it'd be people like Robert Bob for the Detroit schools.
Right. Absolutely. And they're now, you know, they're talking about under Governor Snyder's plan, they're going to close 70 Detroit schools, which could mean increasing high school classes to more than 60 students.
60 per class. I couldn't believe that.
Any teachers out there that feel they could do that?
I subtaught, and 28 was completely exhausting.
Yeah.
Middle school is going to be like college. You'll go into a huge dormitory and there'll be one person in the front talking.
There you go. I mean, into a big classroom
yeah,
with 120. Yeah, you know what? There's always a high school, in high schools, I have to say, there is a discipline problem. And dealing with, you know, 60 kids.
Good luck.
Could be
and
something.
And for me, they were all taller than me.
Yeah, there
very
you go.
Scary.
All right, Eric, thank you very much. Actually, I'm going to begin teaching Tai Chi class on Tuesday.
Yeah.
At a suburban high school.
Oh, very good.
And they wanted me to teach 25 kids. I said, I can't do it.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
You know.
I said, you're going to have to split the class in half. Because even 25, I mean, that's, you know, it's, Tai Chi's kind of subtle and you got to show people, you got to demonstrate stuff. I mean, you can, if you stand up in the front of a class and just demand every kid shut up and everything like that, it's one thing.
That's
but,
not how you roll.
No,
herbs.
No. But, yeah, actually.
No.
You should see my class syllabus.
Yeah, I'm not taking that class.
Yeah. Rule number one, quiet voices, quiet bodies. Yeah. Right. But in any event, the point being is that size is relevant to the capacity to teach. And to start talking about, particularly in poor schools, with 60 kids.
That's insane.
Yeah. And if you think about this, and if there are people, there's got to be, no one calls in anymore and disagrees with us. If you want, 313-298-WRIF, which is
313-298-9743.
Yeah. That if you, most of this comes off the back of, you start from the low end of the poor, then go up to the lower ends of the working class, and then into the middle class. What's going to happen to these people that don't have Medicare? Medicare. Not Medicare. Medicaid. What's going to happen when you you start eroding the quality of education even more for poor people? What do you think is going to be the social result of this? Well, you know what? It'll be, like we said earlier, it'll be Guatemala. The top third, there'll just be a top third and then the bottom two-thirds. And the top third will all live in gated communities and my favorite always was that when these they have these walled communities, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they put cement on top, and then they break bottles.
I've seen it firsthand.
Yeah.
In Mexico.
Yeah, exactly.
Around a house I went to visit.
Yeah, and what have you? And then you know, of course, in your little walled area, you'll have probably pay to have somebody there with an AK-47.
There are a lot of big dogs.
Yeah,
right there,
a lot of
too.
Big dogs, yeah. And we'll just. Or will it be we? You know, everybody thinks, oh, well, I'll be in the top third.
Well, yeah. Keep dreaming.
Good luck. One of the things that they're doing, they're using prison labor to close the budget gaps. And what happens, of course, and we haven't seen this, fortunately, but as conditions, economic conditions worsen, people lose more jobs, people start preying on one another. So the crime rate will go up. You'll get more people in prison. So all these prisons that look like they're closing, they'll, you know, that'll be the prison industrial complex.
So they're right? hoping.
And what will go on will be that what were once well-paying union jobs. So here's a guy. Wait a minute. He's got a well-paying union job. They bust the union. Then they contract his job out. He loses his job. He goes on unemployment. He loses his unemployment, and then he gets desperate, and he commits a crime, right?
Mm-hmm.
He gets sent to prison, and then they send him back to do the job that he originally had.
Oh, my gosh.
I don't know why.
I didn't even thought that far into it.
Wow. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Jerry in St. Clair Shores. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. I just got a quick joke I'd like to share with you.
Yeah?
A unionized employee, a member of the Tea Party, and a CEO are sitting at a table. In the middle of the table, there's a plate with a dozen chocolate chip cookies on it. The CEO reaches across and takes 11 cookies, bags them up, and sticks them in his pocket. Then he looks over at the Tea Partier and says quietly, "Look out for that union guy. He wants a big piece of your cookie."
There you go.
I saw that one earlier. That's good. Good one.
All right. Thanks, Jerry.
Thanks for sharing.
We appreciate that. Yeah. Here's a column gives you an idea. Well, you know what? I saw, I've got so much stuff here. There's so much on all of this. Hey, by the way, if you're really interested, and I hope a lot of you are, and in fact, I hope your interest takes you into action. I said this last week, at least at a different time.
Start with baby steps, you know?
Yeah. Well, but
right now we need bigger steps.
This could be the 1930s or the 1960s. I mean, there was other periods, 1880s, times like that, 1770s. That was kind of interesting period, too. And, you know, probably great numbers, maybe even a majority of people don't take part in those, direct part in those epochs where the history is made. But the capacity of people to make history is there, and we do it over and over again. I mean, you read some of the history books, and it's great men and wars and all that, and that does shape things, to be sure. But very frequently, particularly in countries like ours, the common people wanting an end to slavery, wanting the vote for women, wanting wars to end, wanting gay rights, we'll get to that in a second, by the way, that's been done by the average common person. And you can either be just a spectator and say, you know, say you're 19 right now, and in 40 years, you're almost 60, and your kids say to you, "Hey, back in that era the 2010s,
these giant protests,
what did you do, Mom? What did you do, Dad?" I didn't do anything. And it's not that. It's not like you want to tell your kids war stories or anything like that. It's a matter, and when
it's inspiring them as well.
Yeah. When you read accounts of people that took part in this, in the civil rights movement or in the union movement of the 1930s, these are events that marked their lives, and they were doing it. I mean, they acted sort of self-actualized, but at the same time created a different country.
Yeah. Can you imagine, Peter, if either of you you or I decided to ever have kids, which we both decided we're not.
Yeah. We're dinks. Dinks. Green, what is it? Green inclinations, no kids.
Then we are.
There's a gink manifesto.
But I think we would have had some pretty cool little activist kids.
I don't know. Maybe they'd start reading Ayn Rand.
I hope not. We'd have to lock them up. Can I talk about this action? Because we got an email from Jobs with Justice.
Oh, I got that too, but go ahead.
Okay, good. This Friday, March 4th, from 4:30 to 5:30 at the Labor Legacy Monument at Hart Plaza, there is a gathering, an action. And it says, 10 years ago, Bush cut taxes for those who need help the least, the upper 1%. And it's about show us the jobs. So come stand for the workers this Friday, starting at 4:30 at Hart Plaza. And thank you, Kim, for sending that to us.
4:30 to 5:30, Friday, March 4th. And, one of the things here, if the private sector cannot provide jobs, which apparently it can't because we've allowed all these companies to destroy employment, particularly industrial employment in this country, by saying it's okay. They want to go to China, if they want to go to Mexico, it's okay, where they can pay those people awful wages, and rather than paying us decent wages. There probably needs to be something like the old WPA program. WPA stood for Works Progress Administration. And that was the Roosevelt stimulus program of the 1930s. They built over almost 700,000 miles of roads. They WPA workers, unemployed Americans paid by the government, repaired or improved 124,000 bridges. They built 125,000 public buildings. They built over 8,000 parks, 853 airport landing fields, and on and on and on like this. And so we say, well, wait a minute. We got a deficit going here. How in the world can we afford to pay even one person, let alone talking about millions of people, putting them back to work? Again, there is all this impacted wealth that's not doing, they're certainly not doing the nation any good, and it's not even doing the people that command it any good. Because if you have somebody like who's, I think, the 10th richest guy, Mayor Mike Bloomfield of New York.
Bloomberg,
yeah. I'm thinking of Mike Bloomfield, the guitarist.
Right.
Yeah, Mike Bloomberg. It didn't sound right. Mike Bloomberg, he's got $18 billion. So, and it's in like the bank, right? It's in, you know, in investments. Yeah. So, I mean, he's got everything he wants, right? And still, there's no way in the world. I mean, I don't even understand why he has it. I've said this before. Like if the state of New York is, I don't know, several billion dollars in debt, why does he write a check?
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's $3 billion. You know, get on with your lives. Yeah, stop all this crap going on. All right. 313-298-WRIF. Open lines for you. Here's David in Pontiac. Hi, David. You're on the air. Hey, David.
How you doing?
David, turn your radio off.
Yeah, sorry about that.
That's okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was listening to the thing about the civil rights violations of everybody.
Yeah.
And I really agree with that because my rights have been violated in many ways.
Well,
yeah.
Be quiet. I'm on the air, dude.
This is the only talk show I've ever heard where this goes on.
It does, though.
Well, let me tell you, you got to keep a lookout for actions that are going on. You got to take part in them. If your rights have been violated and people have been hurt in so many different ways. What?
Yep. Yeah, it's really crazy,
you know?
Be quiet.
Well, okay.
Be quiet. I'm on the air.
That was him coming back 30 seconds late.
Right.
David, you're going to have to listen to the rest of it on the air.
Yeah.
Open lines for
and
you,
next
3-1.
Time, make sure that you turn that radio all the way down. Listen in the phone.
Bob Herbert, one of my favorite columnists.
Columnist
in the New York Times. Very deep beneath the stories about executive bonuses, the stock market surge and the economy's agonizing slow road to recovery is the all but silent suffering of the many millions of Americans who economically are going down for the count. I saw some figure. I don't want to exaggerate, but I think it said here. No, I remember now the figure. 70% of Americans either suffered some economic damage, lack of a better word, or know somebody that has. Yes. And I guess I have.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm surprised that number is that low.
Yeah. He says, and he tells these stories, a 46-year-old teacher in Charlotte, Vermont, who has been unable to find a full-time job and is weighed down with debt, wrote to his U.S. Senator, Bernie Sanders, I am financially ruined. I find myself depressed and demoralized. My confidence is shattered. Worst of all, as I hear more and more talk about deficit reduction and further layoffs, I have the agonizing feeling that the worst may not be behind us. And to live with that, rather than having this sense of optimism, something that's been present for generations in this country, that I'm doing okay, but my children are going to do even better than that. If you don't have children like Jolene and I, well,
individually, in our own separate lives.
Yeah. Whatever.
That would be an interesting child, though.
What, yours and mine?
Yeah. It would be, whew, I don't know. You never know. Sometimes
we're on the air.
They turn out to be the opposite.
Yeah.
It might be a Republican. It's best this didn't happen.
Can we move on?
Yeah.
Bob Herbert continues, similar stories of hardship and desolation can be found throughout Vermont and the rest of the nation. The true extent of the economic devastation and the enormous size of that portion of the population that is being left behind has not yet been properly acknowledged. What is being allowed to happen to those being pushed out or left out of the American mainstream is the most important and potentially most dangerous issue facing this country. Wow.
Scary.
Goes on like that. 26-year-old man who emerged from college with big dreams wrote to Senator Sanders, quote, I had hoped to be able to support not just myself by this point, but to be able to think about settling down and starting a family. My family always told me that an education was a ticket to success, but all my education seems to have done in this landscape is make it impossible to pull myself out of debt and begin a successful career.
I hear that from
Yeah, because he owes all this money. Get this.
Well, there's a lot of people who've defaulted on their student loans, more than imaginable.
According to the National Employment Law Project, a trend is growing among employers to not even consider the application of the unemployed for jobs that become available. Is that real clear? Let me read that again. A trend is growing among employers to not even consider the applications of the unemployed for jobs when they become available. Among examples offered by the project were a phone manufacturer that posted a job announcement with the message, no unemployed candidate will be considered at all. An electronics company in Texas announced online that it would, quote, not consider review anyone not currently employed.
I don't get it.
Regardless of the reason. They figure they want only the best employees. And
if they're unemployed, they're not?
Yeah.
That is such crap.
Yeah.
Absolute crap. Yeah.
Well, you're going to get mad at me, or maybe the callers will. There's some real perverse logic to that.
Perverse. Being the key word.
That is to say that companies are probably going to keep the absolute best employees.
Okay.
All right?
Although, well, I'd like to think, you know.
That's not always true.
We're in that category.
A lot of people we know have gotten fired, which seemed to me to be really good employees. So that's it. Now, this is a buyer's market. Remember, labor is about being bought. We're bought and sold on the market. And these nutball libertarians who want the free market, as they call it, to determine everything. If we allowed a free market in labor, we'd be working for $3 an hour. All of us. Of course,
yes.
I said a few months ago, that would bring all the jobs back here because,
hire more people.
Yeah, if we worked at the same wage and no benefits and the same hours as, say, Chinese workers or Bangladeshi workers, they'd say, well, why do we have our company over there? So that would be the end result of these people that say, you know, there shouldn't be any controls, for instance, on labor. There shouldn't be any minimum wage or something like that. Let's see. This is the environment that is giving rise to worker protests in Wisconsin, Ohio, and elsewhere. The ferment is not just public employees and their unions. Researchers at Rutgers University found last year that more than 70% of respondents to a national survey had either lost a job or had a relative or close friend who had lost a job. That is beyond ominous, said Bob Herbert. The great promise of the United States is its primary offering to its citizens and the world is at great risk. A couple facing foreclosure in Barre, Massachusetts, wrote to Senator Sanders, we are now at our wits' end and in dire straits. Our parents have since left this world and with no place to go, what are we to do and where are we to go? They pray to God, they said, that we will not end up living in their car in the cold.
Ugh.
And that's
no joke.
And Jolene and I are, what do you say, just old?
Old what?
What something puss? Tear.
What are we?
You know, that we cry easy.
Oh,
something puss.
We're wimpy.
No.
No?
You had something puss.
I did?
Yeah.
That's scary.
Yeah. I can't remember what it was. Hey, there's some open line. You know, you remember you said that I just think you're a something or other puss when you were, and I said, I don't think it, you are. And that was tugging at my tear ducts. I mean, here are people that tried their damnedest. They didn't do a thing wrong. They was using those words before that people get fired, misfeasance, malfeasance. They worked their butts off.
Yes.
And the working class, the middle class, has had it hard at work for a long time. I mean, that's one of the results of Reaganomics. People worked longer hours, had less vacation. You know, the United States has less vacation days and hours than any of the industrialized countries.
Greatest country in the world.
Yeah. And number one in that, not much else. And so these people have been, thrown aside. They're all used up. There's an old labor folk song called that in itself is almost enough to, you know, to bring you to tears. But they're all used up. They're just not useful to production. The efficiency determined that they had to be let go. They did nothing. They tried their damnedest. And the wealthy, they're riding high. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Who's watching your home when you're not there? It could be a burglar. Burglars prefer to break in when they think no one is home and no one will stop them. Don't be an easy target for intruders. Protect your home with a free security system monitored by ADT, the leader in home security. Pick up your phone now and get free hardware, free medical and fire alerts, and free activation. It's an $850 value. Just call Protect Your Home, your authorized ADT dealer, at 1-877-653-8844. You'll get 24-hour protection, and there's no cost for parts or activation. Call now about a free security system monitored by ADT. Call 1-877-653-8844. $99 installation charge, 36-month monitoring agreement at $35.99 per month. Call for terms and conditions to this offer and protect your home license numbers. Call now, 1-877-653-8844. That's 1-877-653-8844.
If you think of yourself as a technical person and want to pursue a career in technology, get started by calling ITT Technical Institute. At ITT Tech, you can develop knowledge and skills to pursue opportunities in a variety of career fields. Fields like electronics technology, information technology, and drafting and design. Call 800-741-5123. Thousands of graduates have launched new careers after attending the ITT Techs nationwide. Classes and day or evening courses meet at convenient times and teach skills used in the workplace. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career services are available for graduates. Make a technology degree program part of who you are. Call ITT Technical Institute for more information. Call right now. 800-741-5123. 800-741-5123. That's ITT Tech. 800-741-5123.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour at 1 a.m. Eastern Time. Kind of continue this conversation about what's happening to our economy, how people are fighting back against the Republican and right-wing attempt to strip us of our standard of living that our I don't know, us, our ancestors, like our parents, those are ancestors, and our grandparents and our great-grandparents have fought for. It's all going to be rolled back. And people are now starting to say, People still occupying the Wisconsin Capitol tonight. Do we ever get a final on Best Picture? And
it was King's Speech. And
really?
It was Colin Firth.
Yeah. Well, Colin Firth is a great actor.
Great. Wonderful. Yeah.
That's interesting that film.
It did it.
Yeah.
He was expected to win.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me see. Oh, one... Two side notes. Other things in the world happen. President Obama, in a striking legal and political shift, has determined that the Defense of Marriage Act, the 1996 that bars federal recognition of same-sex marriage, is unconstitutional and has directed the Justice Department to stop defending the law in court. That's great.
Yes, it is. But what does it mean?
Well, it means that there can be, when a state approves gay
then
marriage,
they have to recognize
the federal government. Yeah,
that's what I thought. Okay.
Yeah, so that's excellent. So, and one of the things that's interesting, and of course, like all politicians, you know, you got to remember, this was a Republican law that was signed by Bill Clinton.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, that's right.
Yeah.
He did quite a few of those.
And since Clinton is a liberal guy, he certainly didn't oppose gay marriage. And half the Republican politicians are gay, right?
Oh, of course.
So,
come on.
Yeah. So, and it's interesting. I was reading the reaction
and
to this. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Anything, yeah.
That they're just all these closeted guys. In fact, when this went down, when this law, the Defense of Marriage Act, the head of the Republicans was, I can't think of his first name, a guy named Melman, who was a closeted...
Larry Bud?
No. He was...
I'm just kidding.
This Melman guy was maybe head of the Republican Party or something like that. But he was gay, and now he's a gay activist. You know, and on the other hand, he was
amazing.
Doing... Yeah. So, I mean, what the gay issue was raw meat to these homophobes in the Republican base.
Sure.
But the only people that even have put up much of a squawk about this is, you know, these far right wing Christians. Because this really is not much of an issue, given what we are facing. All right, any thoughts on that? I don't even know what can you say. I don't know. All right, let's see. Let's go to Pat. Pat's in Marine City. Hi, Pat. You're on the air.
Hi. I just want to talk, just because this is I'm new here.
Hi, welcome.
You're new to Marine City?
No, I'm new to on the air. I've never been
on the night call show. Okay. Welcome.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi. Hi. In fact, it says you wanted to say hi, so you did.
We're so glad.
Are you listening to the show?
Yeah.
And you're interested in politics?
No.
Oh, okay.
You just wanted to say hi. All right.
Well, there you go. Your big debut.
All right, Pat.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Here's Fred in Detroit. Fred, hi. You're on the air. Hey, Fred, why can't people figure this out? You got to hear, folks, when you get on, Aaron's waiting for your call, and I'm sure he tells you to listen to the show on hold, because we're on something now. We spent a 7-second delay. We're on a 30-second delay.
Yeah, because
now.
All of your potty mouths. No, just kidding.
No. Hey, did I say at 1 a.m. who I'm going to be interviewing?
You didn't. I think you should, though.
Cindy Estrada, who is one of the vice presidents of the United Auto Workers. And it's incredible that the president, Bob King, has made. This is the first Latina that he has had, that the UAW has had on the board, and she's head of the organizing department. Very dynamic. It was a great conversation. I look forward to working with her more.
Great. Yeah. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. We used to work, Julian and I used to work for the UAW in their radio division.
We did.
And we didn't get on famously with the then president of the UAW, Ron Gettelfinger.
Liked you a little better than me.
You think
so?
We're
not going to say why. Remember?
Oh, no. That wasn't Ron. That was Steve Jokic.
Yeah, that's who I meant.
Yeah.
Gettelfinger,
yeah.
I think, just plain didn't...
Like, either.
He didn't like spending all the money on that radio
station.
Network.
That's right. All right, here's Mohammed in Dearborn. Mohammed, hi, you're on the air.
Hey there, Jalene. I miss you guys.
Well,
hey, Mohammed.
Have we been off?
Well, no, I've been off. I've been working. Well, thank God I've been working when you guys have been on. So.
Well, we're glad you're working. You can always listen to our podcast that come on WRIF.com.
I do sometimes, occasionally, and I will. And
okay.
But I've been a long time listener, though. But I'm a Ford, UAW Ford employee. I've been working for Ford for 11 years. And like you were talking about Gettelfinger, I really wasn't too crazy about Gettelfinger. I'm more of a Jokic man, but, you know, not to mention he's a fellow Arab American as well.
Yeah, what about, what do you think about Bob King?
Bob King, I met him a couple of times. He seems like, you know, the jury's still out on him. But I met him a couple of times. He seems very strong-willed as far as the labor movement. I like him, and not to mention he was a president of the Ford division of the UAW. So,
that's right.
You know, I feel good about having a Ford guy in there. But I've been following, you know, as much as I can with the protests in Wisconsin. What they're trying to do is they're trying to take away their right to strike. Now, our last contract, we made a couple of ratifications in the past couple of years. And they wanted us, and we turned that last ratification down. They wanted us. They said they promised us they would bring us some more work, but we could not strike. And that was a big, big no-no. We'll give up a couple of things understand it. We gave up our COLA. We gave up a couple paid holidays. But once you take away a union member's right to strike, you got nothing.
Yeah, you got no absolutely right. Nothing. But, Mohammed, they are not what they're trying to take away in Wisconsin is the right to collective bargaining. I mean, in some ways, it's even worse than that. People can always walk out, approved or unapproved. But they want to end what unions are really all about. And if you think about it, I think people have made the point, there's no way in the world that stripping unions of their right to collective bargaining and demanding that they be recertified every single year, that doesn't have anything to do with reducing the deficit, does it?
Absolutely not. That's the problem. I mean, how will that happen? How will that help the thing? They're still going to lay people off. They become at-will employees.
Yeah.
When you can't bargain, you're an at-will employee. You might as well go ahead and work at Walmart.
Well, that is the plan. That is to make work in the United States sort of a generalized Walmart. In fact, what I always say that Walmart is leading the way to have one international corporation that'll be called International General.
Right.
And
corporation.
Yeah, and we'll all work for that. All right, Mohammed, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Fred. Fred, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, sorry I missed you a second ago.
That's okay. Go ahead.
But, I was calling to say how much I enjoy Jeffrey Figer's commercials.
Yeah.
How he calls out the citizens about cutting off their noses to spite their faces.
Yeah.
You know, voting for the party of no, not standing up to the conservatives who would gut all the programs, a lot of which really hurt women.
He's had those.
Otherwise.
He's had those on the air. I haven't seen them.
I haven't seen them either.
Yeah, well, basically, he's taking a stand where he is more, rather than a commercial for him and his law firm, it's more about, I don't know, I guess calling up the conservatives.
Wow.
Yeah, well, he can afford those ads. Have you ever seen his his offices? I mean, they're like a block long with statues. You ever seen that up in 10 Mile in Southfield?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah.
I have.
That's
I mean, but the Democrats need more people like him to sort of speak with a singular voice, more authority, you know, and put people in their places instead of being so dispersed.
Yeah, well, they got to be stronger.
More like a rabble, almost.
President Obama's got to be stronger. He finally did, something on the gay issue, but he's got, he should be. In fact, you ever watch Ed Schultz on MSNBC?
Okay.
Yeah, well, anyway, Ed Schultz is calling on President Obama, come to Wisconsin. I mean, that is the Democratic base. That's Barack Obama's base, and he should be there. I mean, he said, 2 weeks before, this looks like an attack on labor. He's never said anything since.
And some people argue that it's a state issue and that he shouldn't get involved in it.
Well, what the hell? I mean, people were making the argument that it was undemocratic for those Democratic Party senators to leave. These are extraordinary times.
Yes.
And you can take extraordinary actions. I mean, imagine that. Firemen and teachers and other state employees all occupying the state capitol. That's pretty unusual, isn't it, Fred?
Yeah.
We don't get that every day.
Well, I do think the man is slightly left of center, but I really think he's got his hands full with the party of no at every turn.
He does.
He does.
But
yeah.
You know what? He and the Democrats, I'm not blaming it just on him, they would do a lot better if they just stood up to him because the majority of people are behind him. I mean, he gets like his approval ratings are below 50%, but that usually, that's no different than most presidents.
Well, what was Bush when he was done? 17?
Yeah, no, it was. But if he, every time Barack Obama does something strong, in fact, almost any president, I mean, look at Bush right after 9/11, what was approval ratings? Like 90%? Even though it was because of his misfeasance, and some people say malfeasance, that 9/11 occurred. Yeah. All right, Fred, thank you so much.
Thanks, Fred.
Appreciate your call. Some open lines for you, 313-298-WRIF. And I, we actually have good news. I mean, I think it's good news that there are these incredible protests against the attack on the middle class and the working class.
I do, too.
Then also the fact that that the Obama administration, I mean, the fact that they actually came out with a strong stand about the gay issue and will not any longer defend this Defense of Marriage Act. What a stupid thing to begin with.
That was, it's ridiculous. But they're, you know, those same folks are still around today and a whole new crop of them saying the same thing. Marriage between between a man and a woman, and when it's not, it's the sanctity goes away, and everything's going to go to hell if them gays get married.
You know what? They're really...
homophobic right-winger voice. Did you like it?
Yeah.
Thank you. I did, too. Thank you.
And remember when that was like a big issue about gay marriage? And I said, I've been married to a woman for a long time, and I didn't understand how that... gays getting married, women marrying women, or men marrying men.
Screw it all
up. Had anything to do with me.
Well, let me tell you. I've been married twice myself.
Yeah.
To a man, two different men.
Yeah.
And that didn't go so well.
Well, it's about a 50-50 crapshoot, isn't it, for marriage? Isn't it 50% of men getting divorced?
Yes, at least.
Yeah. But religion, you know, if it's against people's religion... whatever, you know, so then they so, just...
Well, then just stay out of it, then.
They should just... But civil... I mean, that's where this is all about and why it's unconstitutional, the whole thing about equal protection under the law, the 13th Amendment to the Constitution. These constitutionalists ought to understand this. I mean, there's no way in the world that someone could go into some... I don't know. I don't want to name a denomination and say, you know, we want you to marry us in a religious ceremony, even though it's against your religious principles, right?
Yeah.
But what we're talking about is an arrangement, in a sense, in this society. Marriage is virtually a contract because it has all these legal ramifications.
Sure does.
Property ownership, responsibility,
children,
illness. Yeah. So there's all of that. So that ought to come solely as a civil matter.
You know what makes me really sick is, you know, I haven't talked about this, but I went home to see my family, and... they don't listen to the show, so I can say anything I want. I've always had freedom because they just don't listen to it.
Yeah.
And I don't think they can take it, and their poor hearts are just too weak. Anyhow, so they made me go to church.
This is a couple of weeks ago.
They made my sister, and she was like, you're going. And it wasn't because she was just convinced that I was going to feel it because it's rock and roll and the big old band's up there. And
this is a mega church.
Yeah, this thing is freaking huge. It's got like a gift shop. I'm not kidding you. A coffee shop. It's got everything. This place is just massive. And I remember my mother saying to me, Julian, I got sat down. Did you look around? I said, yeah, Mom, it's a whole lot too much for me. And she just was kind of like, oh, so my point is, this hip church, they all wear jeans and they sing the rock and roll and they accept the gays, but they draw the line at gay marriage. And you know, to me, that's just hypocritical BS. And I wanted to say the word because it feels so good. But I was really my skin was crawling. I couldn't wait to get out of there. And this was one of the ceremonies where they had the communion.
Yeah.
And I said, I'll see you guys outside. You know, I'm sorry. You did enough to me, you know. Saw a few friends, so it was kind of nice to catch up with them, but I couldn't wait to get out and have a glass of wine.
This could kind of be like 1966, if you do an analogy with the civil rights movement. You know? I mean, they were formally had the laws, let me see, the Voting Rights Act had been passed and all that, but really, a lot of social attitudes hadn't caught up with it.
Yeah, well, it's going to take a long time to get somewhere. I mean, my home state of Iowa, which is where I was, gay marriage.
Yeah.
But then, during these last elections, they voted to get rid of all the judges who voted for that.
That's because almost the entire Democratic base stayed home. And the only people that voted
Even
were the
there.
Right-wingers.
Yeah.
Not the only people that voted. But if, you know, if you could do, like, online voting and everybody could go, okay, it's time to...
We have a huge turnout, wouldn't we?
Right.
But they'd find a way to really mess with it because it's the Internet.
There you go.
Anyway, I mean, that's just my point is even if a religion says, you know, it's okay, be gay, be free, but... don't get married. You know what? I know a lot of people would just say, kiss my ass. That's all I have to say. And if you have a problem with gay marriage out there, why? I'd like to know.
Yeah, I don't. Well, if, you know, if sometimes people say, when I think about what they do, it just makes me
sick.
Yeah,
well, what you do makes me sick, too. You know?
Remember
I don't want to hear about anybody's sex life.
Right.
I really don't.
But remember,
it's personal.
What do I always say, though? What they're really talking about is guys. The girls?
Bring it on. Yeah, that's yeah. Bit,
but no one has ever been able to tell us in all the years we've been talking about this. How does gays getting married, does two people, and I always think, one of the publicists I work with is a woman, and she's married to a woman in outside of Boston.
Okay.
And actually they were, where was their, it was on Yahoo News, the two of them, they got married in Massachusetts.
Oh, because when it was new?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so
comments?
The photographs, all these people just looking so happy and saying, yes, we're human beings.
Yes.
And then the people on the other side, I hate you.
Yeah. Why the hate over love? That's another point I don't get, because this is about love. Why hate on love? That means I hate to use the word, but you're a hater, and that's too bad for you, because that's not going to go bode well for you on the inside, in my opinion.
Anybody have a real serious reason?
Solid reason.
Why gay marriage would in any way hurt what you think is traditional marriage?
We haven't talked about this for a while, actually.
313.
We're still looking for the
298 WRIF.
313-298-9743. Open lines. Please tell us.
And here's some
if you support it, we'd like to hear that, too.
Sure. Sure. Here's some good news as well. I didn't get a chance to talk about this.
Wait,
or did I?
We have good news?
Yeah, well, we got...
I have some.
There's a couple of things.
No, of course.
We're fighting back.
Madison's good. I'm just
kidding. Madison's good. The fact that that the Obama administration has realized that the federal act against...
Defense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is not constitutional.
It's a bunch of hooey.
And also now Japan is cutting short this year's annual whale hunt in the Antarctic Ocean.
Oh, good.
After our pals...
Pressure?
The Sea Shepherd Conservation Society chased them out of the Antarctic.
These are our friends, and they are amazing. Yeah. When we talk about cojones of steel and eggs, ovaries, because there's women who are out there, too.
They're going to lose their TV show, though.
No!
Well, they have whale wars on the Animal Planet.
Yeah, but these are the guys actually doing it, right?
Yeah. The Agriculture Ministry of Japan, which runs the widely criticized research whaling program, said harassment by the group, the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, has kept its catch far below its annual target of whales. They only got 170 minke whales, two fin whales, and they wanted 850 minkes and 50 fin.
Well, this is good news.
Yeah, and also they're talking about not even doing it anymore. And one of the things the Sea Shepherds do, they trail these huge whaling ships.
And let's say this. Illegal whaling.
Illegal, yeah, because
it's
banned.
Illegal.
And they throw stink bombs on the whaling ship.
Yeah,
stinky
oil stuff. What was that?
I can't remember what it is. But it says domestic critics in Japan have called the program an anachronism, something that's old hat, out of fashion, because private fishing companies have dropped out under international pressure and the demand for whale meat is declining. Few Japanese eat whale anymore, and the meat from the hunt is piled up in freezers or has been given to children for school lunches.
Oh, poor kids.
I mean, they were eating it as sushi. All right. There's a couple people say they got a reason against gay marriage.
Okay.
Yeah. We're on a 7:30-second delay, folks. So, you say anything weird, you can have your
derogatory,
own.
Derogatory.
No, I mean, you can be, I don't know.
We want you to just say what you want to say.
Say what you want to say.
We've
right,
got
let's
the
start
button.
With,
we've got our finger on the button.
Thomas in Brownston. Hi.
Hey, good evening, Peter and Jolene.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, I was in church this morning, and my pastor brought up a couple really good points about, reasons why gays should marry. And the big one that I wanted to get your reaction to was Peter Wibby being a douchebag.
Oh, hit it, Peter.
Yeah. Okay, we will.
All right.
All right.
Let's talk to a real caller. Can we have one?
Brandon in Harrison Township. Go ahead, Brandon.
Hey, guys. I really don't have nothing against, gay marriage whatsoever.
But
I was recently at my daughter's daddy-daughter dance.
Yeah?
And I was just kind of wanting, you know, and I even, hey, even before this show, I thought about it. I was like, well, what if, you know, a lesbian couple had a daughter that was in third, fourth, fifth grade? You know, how would they approach a situation where, you know, their daughter had this daddy-daughter dance?
I think most likely they wouldn't go. I think that neither of them would go because unless they, I mean, there are some lesbian mothers who call themselves the daddy, but I just think most of them would, you know, not go.
Well, I'm just thinking about, you know, the girl, you know, actually the daughter in her social circles at school, you know, how would that,
well,
how,
you know
that,
what?
What would that mean?
Here's what I think. Hopefully the mothers have taught this girl well enough and to have, you know, a reasonable a train of thought when it goes to this and loved them enough to the where they would say, you know what? It's okay. I have two mommies, and they have enough self-esteem where they say, I'd rather have two mommies anyway. You know, usually that's the kind of situation I've seen.
And also, you know, social change is difficult when you think of, I mean, even something like women entering broadcasting. 30 years ago, Jalene wouldn't be sitting here. You wouldn't see women newscasters. You
right.
Have, two of the, if you think about this, two of the three major networks have anchors that are...
The 5 p.m. or the nightly news.
Yeah, the nightly news.
Amazing.
Yeah.
True.
And so, yeah, there are oftentimes difficulty in adjustments in social situations, the integration, social integration. I'm sure that, you know, where you work or if you go to school or something like that, the fact that there's African Americans or Asians or people from the Middle East is, you know, it's not jaw-dropping anymore. But
yeah.
40 years ago, let's put another 10 years, 40 years ago, mm-hmm. if a black man and a white woman or a white woman and a black man were walking, people would go, oh.
Yeah, you know, I'm amazed that I think people still do.
Well, they maybe do a little, but you know, when you start to when you ask like people under 30 about their you know, gay marriage or interracial marriage, mm-hmm. or something, I mean, they look at you like you're crazy.
Yeah, they're like, who cares? Well,
yeah, what's the deal?
You know, I would just, you know, I'm not a parent.
Thank you, Brandon.
I'm not a parent, Brandon, and I don't know. Well, you said there were a daddy-daughter dance. My encouragement to parents out there is, expose your kids to as much diversity as possible because it's only going to behoove them in life.
Sure. The times, they are changing, as some old guy sang back when he was young.
Yeah, and yeah. They could sing a little better.
You know, we've kind of lost, Wes. God. You know, this cold is never, you know, people are like this. This has been hanging on.
This whole radio station, you can hear it here.
Oh, it's everywhere.
Well over,
it's
yeah.
everywhere.
Is it really?
Yeah,
okay.
Everywhere. I mean, companies have been just devastated by it. But I want to just get back to a couple things about Wisconsin. And we got some people waiting. Al from Detroit. Al, hang on. The rest of you, hang on to open lines as well. 313-298-WRIF. And the governor of Wisconsin, Scott Walker, he's the one that has proposed stripping the public employee unions of their collective bargaining rights.
Which I don't even, there's some people who aren't in the unions who don't understand what collective bargaining rights are. Maybe you could.
Well, it means you sit down with your employer, the representative of all of you, because as an individual, you have no power whatsoever. You know, you go in there and you say, I want a $10 an hour raise. Yeah. I'm cutting your wages $5.
Yeah, yeah.
Too bad. Whereas if you represent all the employees and you have the capacity to strike, for instance, then you have some power. And unions aren't greedy. I mean, one of the things that have people say, well, you know, they ruined the economy. Well, I mean, that's absolute nonsense. Wall Street ruined the economy. And in fact, if there's a company that agreed to pay in or a whole compensation package, which was more than was economically feasible, well, it's just bad management. But what were we looking at? The bottom 90% of the wage earners in this country make $31,000 a year, and a lot of the state employees were making that as well. So my contention is, and a lot of people, that the Scott Walker is just a puppet for these billionaires, particularly and very directly the Koch brothers. And David Koch.
Google it.
yeah. K-O-C-H, by the way. And the Koch brothers, there's David, what's the other guy's name? I actually forgot now. But anyway, He is a billionaire whose political action committee, a PAC, directly supported Walker and has given millions to groups that have run ads that aided his election because you're restrained. Well, the Koch PAC not only spent $43,000 directly on Walker's race, which is a big deal, $43,000, but he personally donated $1 million to the Republican Governors Association,
yikes,
which spent $5 million in the state denouncing the Democratic candidate.
A lot of money in Wisconsin, pouring into Wisconsin.
And also the Koch brothers have a lot of vested interest in Wisconsin. They have the Koch Pipeline Company, which operates a pipeline system that crosses Wisconsin. It also owns Flint Hill Resources, which distributes refined fuel through the pipelines at terminals in Junction City, Waupun, Madison, and Milwaukee. Koch Industry also owns the Sea Rice Coal Company, a power plant company located in Green Bay.
Okay, power,
on and on.
Okay.
Yeah. The Koch brothers opened a lobby office where they're going to lobby the government 2 days after Walker was elected, right?
Oh, geez.
Yeah. And what's called the bonus repair bill also allows the no bid, means you don't get bids to get the highest bid, a no bid sell off of any state owned heating, cooling, or power plant. Get that the Koch brothers could buy.
Oh, geez.
I mean, again, our favorite R word.
Racket.
Yeah. So this enterprising, let me see, who was this guy? He was a news guy. He called up Governor Walker and posed as David Koch, pretending to be the billionaire.
Oh, yeah, I heard this.
Yeah. By the way, you can go to my website, Peter Werby,
WERBE.com,
and you can hear the whole thing. First off, you realize what immediate access David Koch has to his little puppet.
Oh, yeah.
And why he was fooled, I don't know. So they talk about all these things, how they're going to break the unions, how they're going to force these Democratic senators back into the Senate.
Well, and how they wanted to go in and send people to disrupt the crowd on purpose.
Yeah, that's right. The fake Koch brother, David, says says we'll back you any way we can. But we've been thinking about the crowd was planting some troublemakers. And you would think that the governor would say, man, that's a horrible idea. But he says that they considered that idea.
Yeah,
and
we considered it.
And then rejected. That was his words. We considered hiring troublemakers to disrupt the rally. They had elementary school children and high schoolers and what have you. He said, we thought about that, but they rejected the idea because he said it might backfire in case because of the publicity. Not that you might hurt people, not like you might take up to, 100,000 or more people there that were behaving in just the way we'd want every demonstration ever to be, peacefully cleaning up after themselves, as they chant, this is what democracy looks like. Not because they would send in thugs to disrupt all this, but because they might get bad publicity.
Yeah, it's not even on their mind.
Yeah.
The people.
Towards the end of the call, the fake Koch brother offers to fly Walker out to California after they crush the bastards and to show Walker a good time. To which Walker responds with enthusiasm in his voice, all right, that would be outstanding. Well, Wisconsin rules bar state officials from taking action for anything of value. That he agreed to the junket. And then the fake Koch brother says, and we have a little bit of a vested interest as well. And Governor Walker says, well, that's just it. So, this guy should be impeached. This guy should be prosecuted. There are so many ethical violations in this.
And in reality, do you think any of that will happen?
Well,
there's a possibility.
The police chief of Madison said he wants to ask the governor to explain his troubling statements, and he wants to know who in the inner circle were the people that did this. I mean, there is such a thing called there's laws of conspiracy.
Yeah.
And if people are conspiring to do this, although they might at the last minute decided, that's not any less of a crime. All right, let's take some calls. 313-298-WRIF. Here is, here's Josh in Garden City. Hi, Josh, you're on the air.
Hey, guys, good to talk to you. Long time listener, first time call.
Hey,
well, thank you,
Josh.
First of all, I'd like to say thank you guys for supporting the unions and in labor and the middle class. I really appreciate that.
Got to do it.
We're in the right town for that, aren't we?
Yeah. Huh? Yeah. Hey, I'm 10 years strong UAW.
Right on, man.
But no, I just want to talk about the gay marriage. You know,
sure.
I just don't get it. I thought religion and politics were supposed to be separate.
Yeah, I thought we had a constitution that talked about that.
Yeah, you know, and I look at it this way. The world's so full of hate and backstabbing and disunity that why would we basically legislate someone from loving someone?
Yeah, and therefore making them further second-class citizens.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think that's over. You know, I'm not trying to end the call. I mean, I think that as having social affirmation is gone, and everything that we've ever had to do. Remember, as I always say, the conservatives have been on the wrong side of every single question. Every social and political question since the beginning of our country when they opposed the American Revolution, right? The conservatives wanted us to stay a colony of Britain. And they've been on the wrong side of slavery, of segregation, of women's rights, of every war that was cockeyed that the United States was in, on and on and on. They were opposed to unions. They were opposed to Social Security. They were opposed to Medicare. They have a track record of batting zero in terms of human concern and progress, right?
Yeah, they're out of touch with the general public. They have no idea how we live or how we think or what we need. They don't care.
Well, but that's the point, Josh. It's not, if you told me I was out of touch with what people want, if I told you that, we'd say, wait a minute, we want to know what's good for the majority of people. The conservative movement has always been about the ultra wealthy. And that's why, for instance, what they call the Tories, the people that supported continued English rule in 1776, it was about the elite. I mean, a lot of the financial elite of the United States or of the colonies wanted the revolution as well. But the ones that didn't, it wasn't like political concerns. It was that it was financial stuff as well. So, I mean, it is such a nuisance that we have to, that we've been fighting these right wingers for 300 years, to bring about, which could have been done so easily. 'Cause they could just say, yeah, okay, women want to vote. All right, let's go. Segregation, let's let it go, because that really is ugly, and it besmirches our image in the world, and it does such horrible damage to people. And the same with slavery and all, you know, so many of these stupid wars. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your calls. I mean, they make life so hard.
They really do.
Life is hard, you know, even in the best of circumstances.
Yes.
Things go wrong, but it's like they conspire. They are part of the conservatives are a part of a conspiracy to make life even harder than it needs to be.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julian Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julian will be taking more of your calls right after this.
I've got a question for all you business owners out there. How would you like to see customers coming through your door today, and the next day, and the day after that? Well, if you're looking to drive customers to your local Motor City business, I may just have the answer you've been looking for. MotorCityDailyDeal.com. It's a simple program that really works for local businesses. First things first, there are no upfront costs to be a part of the MotorCityDailyDeal.com program. It's a partnership with your success as the goal. Their marketing pros work with you to develop the perfect deal to bring customers right to your business. Then MotorCityDailyDeal.com uses the power of great Motor City radio stations like WRAF, social media, and an effective daily email sent to tens of thousands of consumers right here in the Motor City who are looking to try out new restaurants, bars, stores, golf courses, salons, spas, you name it. And did I mention that you get a check within 10 days of your successful deal running? Yeah, that's right. Cash in your pocket and customers in the door. MotorCityDailyDeal.com. Connecting local customers to local businesses is what it's all about at MotorCityDailyDeal.com.
Why do we go through so much hassle for our morning coffee? We make it, wait in line for it, fuss with cream and sugar. There has to be a faster and easier way to shake the morning blunts. There is. 5-Hour Energy. It's ready right now. No making, waiting, or fussing required. And it really works. Just open it up, knock it back, you're done in seconds. Now that's fast and easy. 5-Hour Energy. The no wait, no hassle way to a great morning. Try it today.
Individual results may vary. See 5hourenergy.com for more details.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back to our final segment at 2 a.m. How about 1 a.m.?
1 a.m. I
can do this
be better.
So, yeah, 1 a.m.
Yeah.
I'll be playing an interview I did Friday with Cindy Estrada, who is the vice president, one of the vice presidents of the United Auto Workers, talking about some of the same stuff we have been. We were talking about the success of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society that literally drove the illegal Japanese whaling ships out of the Antarctica. Which, you know, they say they're doing it. The Japanese
not
say
an
they're
easy
doing
thing
it.
To do.
No, they say they're doing it. The Japanese say they're doing it for research.
Yeah, which is nonsense. Full of it.
But we were saying that they were, the sea shepherds were throwing kind of these stink bombs. But what they were, and I'm not, how do you say this? Butyric mm-hmm. acid, or basically rancid butter. This is what the sea shepherds were throwing
right,
on the decks.
Right, that's what it was.
And it smells bad and is slippery and mildly corrosive. Thanks, Eric from Sarnia. Writing into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. All right. Let's go back to our phones and pick up Al in Detroit. Hi, Al. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Whoa. I can't even hear you, Eric. You talking into your phone?
Yeah, hey, how you doing, guys?
Yeah, that's better.
Go ahead.
You?
Yeah.
All right. Sorry about that. I had a little bit of trouble with my phone. But, yeah, I mean, I actually work at a gay bar here in Detroit.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm not gay, but, I mean, I would just have a fear that half these guys, because, I mean, I see these guys on a daily basis, these guys, I would have a fear that two gay guys raising a son would influence and maybe even molest half of them.
Why would you think that?
These guys, I see them every day. I work down here.
No, I know. You see them every day. But what makes you think that somebody, two loving men would, I mean, you know, hey, there's a lot of heterosexual couples that molest their kids, as we know. Why do you think that the average would be any higher among homosexual couples as heterosexual couples? We know that there's a lot of abuse of children by parents, right? By heterosexual parents.
I understand where you're coming from, but, I mean,
I'm not coming from anywhere. I'm asking you, why would you think that a homosexual couple of men, for instance, you see guys, would have a higher rate of abuse of children than a heterosexual couple?
Well, it would be more the flamboyant ones, not so much the ones that...
Okay, flamboyant. Why?
I'm not buying this at all.
Why would flamboyancy
crazy.
Translate into sexual abuse? Yeah, I don't know. It's a prejudice.
Because
forget
it doesn't.
It do your job. You, love your customers.
Maybe you should go get another job.
Yeah, or something like that. What would they think if they knew you were
they
saying
would be
stuff like
bummed
that?
Bummed out.
Yeah, they probably think you're a pal.
He should have said where he worked, and then his boss would be like, bye.
Yeah, all right. More calls at 313-298-WRIF. Here's Randy in Westland. Hi, Randy. You're on the air.
Hi. I just want to talk about the unions. Just people don't realize that without the unions, we wouldn't have as good a living that we have now, like the middle class. We wouldn't have that at all if there was no unions. They wouldn't offer non-union people as good as wages as they do right now. And the union is...
For sure. You know, that's why they sent... you know, if you go back into the 19th century, I don't know if you've ever seen stuff on television or read stuff or whatever, but, man, when we... I'm talking about, you know, the average people back, say, in the... Oh, even into the 20th century, they you know that, like, some of these mining strikes or, like, up in Upper Peninsula or... They brought in the National Guard and they shot down men, women, and children. I mean, because you know what? They said, we don't want to work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week for, you know, for absolutely nothing. And
yeah,
so,
like how dare they, right?
Yeah. And so they went on strike and what the hell? Governor would call the National Guard out and they'd have some encampment like out in, forget, like in Idaho and just, shoot into the camp, kill people, Chicago police, 1938. That's not so long ago. Workers are having a picnic trying to organize United Steel Workers. and the Chicago cops just opened fire on workers. I mean, and this was all about protecting profits. They didn't want to pay us more. They wanted to work us to death. They couldn't care less about us or our lives.
We'd be a third world nation ourselves right now if it wasn't for the union.
Randy, I hate to scare you, but we're on our way.
Oh, I know we're on our way.
So we got to fight. And what I was saying, I don't know if you were hearing my rant early in the show, but the fight back is beginning. And if we can be part of it, we can be part of history. This could be, like the 1930s. This could be like the 1960s. This could be epoch changing days. And we can either sit back and watch it on television or, maybe get some internet, get some messages or something like that. We can be out and part of it. And if you're part of a union, it's real easy. If you're not, it's a little more difficult. But, keep a lookout for action that are going on. Look what's happening in Wisconsin. It's absolutely amazing. All right. Thank you very much. And think about what kind of paltry turnout the teabaggers had and the power that they were able to exert.
Amazing.
It is amazing. We can do the same thing.
In a bad way.
Yeah. Here's Ed. Ed's in Taylor. Go ahead, Ed. You're on the air.
Hi there, Pete and Julene.
Hello.
I was, hearing about the Koch brothers being doing a lot of the funding and that for the Tea Party and being behind the Tea Party.
Right.
And it's like I got a new name for the Tea Party.
What's that?
The Koch Party.
That's good.
Yeah, we should tell people. I mean, it works best verbally because one of the things they say in Wisconsin, they say we don't want a cokehead as a governor, and their name is spelled K-O-C-H, but it's pronounced Coke. I think wasn't the mayor of no relation, but the mayor of New York? Yeah, he called himself Koch, I think.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. Ed Koch.
Ed Koch, right. Right. And Coke may be the German pronunciation. Yeah, probably. But, we don't need no Cokeheads. That's for sure. Good point, Ed. Thank you. Let's see. Here is Paul. Paul's in Plymouth. Oh, Paul. Hi. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. How are you guys this evening?
Go ahead. Paul is our connection to the Michigan film industry.
Hey, Paul.
Hi. Just want to fill you guys in with what's been going on this week. There was a big meeting over in Livonia at the Laurel Manor.
There was.
On Tuesday.
Mitch Albom and the folks?
Mitch Albom, Jeff Daniels showed up.
Oh, really?
Cool.
Your union leaders and all the crew people that, of course, work on the movies, as well as those people that, supply the movies, from hotel managers to caterers, all the way across the board.
Yeah.
And about 1,000 people showed up. And so there's quite a bit of support.
Wow. 1,000 people.
1,000 people were packed in there.
You know what, Paul? I don't know if everybody knows exactly what we're talking about. This is that Governor Snyder here in Michigan is talking about ending the film credits
incentives.
The film incentives.
Well, he's the Governor Snyder is basically going to reduce the funding to a maximum of $25 million. Which is really a bare minimum when we're giving 40% back to film companies that come in. So, of course, with every, say, like Gran Torino that was shot here, that was a $20 million movie. So they got about $8 million back in tax credits. How far will $25 million go? Not very far.
No.
We were hoping that, maybe we could get some of your audience together, if they would maybe go to the website. Can I mention it?
Sure, yes. Absolutely.
It's rickswrong.com.
Okay.
Ricks, R-I-C-K-S-W-R-O-N-G.
Yes, Rickswrong. Wrong. Yes.
Okay.
.com. And, sign the petition there. And, we all understand what's happening with our budget, the billion-dollar deficit that we face. But $25 million is low. If he would at least consider maybe $100 million to $150 million, you could keep this momentum going in the movie business.
Keep it really healthy here. I'll put it on our Facebook as well,
sure.
And I'll put it on mine.
Well, now, Paul, you probably know the criticisms, and I don't know if you saw the Metro Times. I think it was this week or last week. There was a full-page ad denouncing Mitch Albom and the people that want to continue with the film tax credits, and they say this is a net loss for the state. We're just doing a giveaway. I mean, how do you answer that?
Well, I mean, I don't want to shoot myself in the foot, but I can see their side of their point as well. And there's a few things we could tighten in that incentive to stop this from being a net loss. But there is a loophole for 30% tax credit to out-of-state employees.
Uh-huh.
So you're getting a lot of these films that come in, and they're bringing their people from, you know, Louisiana, New Mexico, all those states that had 25% incentives who are out of work. They're coming here to work. And maybe if we got rid of the 30% and we put in a residency requirement, which I hate to do that, but saying you have to live here for at least 2 years, 2 or 3 years, to qualify for the tax credit. You know, that would create more training for Michigan people to get back to work, mm-hmm. as well as keep Michigan people employed. You know, that might be one of the solutions. And, you know, I understand their...
In other words, you can deal with this creatively rather than throwing the baby out with the bathwater, as the statement goes, right?
Sure. It would be even nice if maybe our governor would, you know, extend an olive branch out to Hollywood, maybe to the studios. There's uh-huh. been a lot of studios that have been trying to been built here to be built here. And maybe if you went to MGM or Paramount and said, hey, we'd really like to have a permanent studio here. How could we make this possible?
Sure.
You know, the local people here are trying to build it, but I think you need that element of the Hollywood studio system to actually make something, you know, that could be long-lasting. And it'd be nice to see them do that, because it really could build an industry here that we, you know, we've always had a film business here for car commercials, and we have little studios here. I'm sure if you might have been to a few in the years past.
Yeah, I have.
Like Grace and Wild, or, you know, Digital, the studios over there in Farmington Hills. So there is this small film family here, but I mean, this thing's been just getting rolling over 3 years. You know, let it go 5 years before you cut it back to 25 million. You know, I understand the issue with some of the people who wrote in Metro Times. How long do we need these incentives before we have an industry built that would be self-sustaining?
Well, that's it. I mean, the old adage is you got to spend money to make money.
Right.
And so what do we have for industry here? I mean, when I hear people, and there's so many people I hear that are excited about, like, urban agriculture in Detroit, which is fine. And there's some people that are doing some amazing things in the communities. But that's you can't base an economy on that, right? I mean, maybe,
but we'll take it. Maybe the more the better of those.
Medical marijuana, maybe. But,
hey, can I mention something outside of this?
Sure. Real quick? Sure.
You know, I was thinking about, you know, corporations and what we need to get this country back on its feet again. We got to get away from companies worried so much about the bottom line. Yes, they have to profit, but we've got to get back to a living wage, health care, and a retirement package. And
well, you know, Paul, you're some kind of radical. I can tell.
I
mean,
I know.
Wait. There is no way ever you're going to get a company with very precious few that aren't going to have what you're calling the bottom line. In other words, maximizing profit as their sole consideration, and couldn't give two toots about their employees or what their policies do to a community. I mean, it just ain't in their DNA. So that's why they have to be forced. That's why government regulation is so important. And that's why unions are so important.
I mean, it seems like that's where we've gone wrong. What union or not, you know, the bottom line should take a living wage, health care, and retirement package should come first. That bottom line should come second. They can still make profits. But when you're making these huge profits and you're laying people off and these people can't provide for their families because their wages are too low. There's got to be some sort of moral compass, and I understand.
There is none. Forget it.
You know, but I think we could get that someday.
I don't. I mean, I think.
Peter, don't be so negative.
Well, here's what. Here, like, for instance, in highly regulated economies, like, for instance, in the Scandinavian countries, they actually do produce a culture and an ethical culture that where all of that is instilled, because they know there that like the CEOs aren't going to make $127 million and their employees are making $9 an hour. It doesn't happen. They'll make $300,000 an hour and the employees will be making $20 an hour.
You know,
and that's an ethical framework within capitalism.
My father has a business he's had for 40 years here in Plymouth, a small business, and he's always taught me, hey, you know, we have good years and bad years. And those bad years, I'm not laying my employees off. If I got to make a little less to keep them comfortable, that's fine. We'll have good years in the years ahead.
Your dad's a good man.
There is. And there are employers like that, for sure. Yeah. Mostly smaller ones as well. But those are getting, you know, pushed out.
You know, you take care of your employees. They take care of you, you know.
Absolutely.
I have to say, even though my dad's a Republican, he did the same when he was a business owner.
All right, Paul. Thank you very much, and we'll put that website up for you.
Yes, absolutely. Once again, that is rickswrong.com.
Right. All right, Paul.
Correct.
Thank you very much. Thanks for our weekly film industry report.
Love it. Yes.
What did he, something he said, oh, yeah, I was thinking about regulation. You know, there's this national budget crunch coming that they think the government, because the Democrats won't agree to enough cuts, like they're cutting all family planning money for Planned Parenthood. God. What do these people think of? One thing, they're against abortion, right?
Yes.
Yet the Planned Parenthood
provides contraception.
Yeah. So they won't be able to do that anymore. So there'll be more babies that more women will want more
need more help with.
And they'll need, there'll be poor kids that will need more state assistance.
More kids starving.
Yeah. So House Republicans have cut funding also to Nobel Prize winning UN climate science body. And America is set to cut off all funding to the United Nations Climate Science Panel under Republican budget cuts that seek to gut spending on environmental protection. Whoa. They don't want to have environmental protection.
Spending.
Yeah.
That's scary.
The funding ban to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change takes all these millions away. If enacted, the cuts package would reduce spending on environmental protection by nearly one-third. This is from the EPA. Mm. The cuts also exhibit the strong hostility to climate science among the Tea Party activists with funding bans on this and a newly created Climate Information Service under the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. Now, here's a teabagger. He is the Attorney General in Virginia, Kenneth, and I haven't tried to pronounce his name yet, Kenneth T. Cuccinelli. He's the crusading Republican Attorney General. He's waging a one-man war on the theory of man-made global warming. Doesn't think it's true. Cuccinelli is suing the Environmental Protection Agency over its ruling that carbon dioxide and other global warming gases pose a threat to human health and welfare, describing the science behind the agency's decision as, quote, unreliable, unverifiable, and doctored. I ask you, dear friends, whose word are you going to take? Thousands of scientists that have no agenda. I don't even get why this has a political agenda to it.
No.
Except these people are just crazy.
Yeah.
That's it. Or Kenneth T. Cuccinelli.
I'm going to take the scientists.
Yeah.
Alex?
Let me see. Michael McKenna, Republican strategist and energy lobbyist. See, what they don't want, any controls on pollution.
They don't want their friends to lose all their money.
Because the Koch brothers would have to spend more money on their plants that are poisoning us all.
Yeah.
Right? That's what it's all about. There's a huge appetite among the rank-and-file right wing to raise fundamental questions about the underlying science. Responding to those concerns, the new Republican majority has introduced legislation that would strip federal regulators of their power to police the industrial emissions that contribute to climate change. But party leaders, treading warily, have cast their arguments against regulation largely in terms of economic consequences. In other words, as I always say, it's capitalist blackmail. What's your choice? Do you want jobs or do you want to be poisoned?
Right.
Yeah. So, does that make sense? Is that the way to pose it? If you have the jobs, you get poisoned. Right. If we have pollution controls, then we lose the jobs. But that's BS anyway. Even dedicated opponents of climate action concede that hauling climate scientists before Congress and challenging their findings could easily backfire. And I get this. As many representatives lack a sophisticated grasp of climatology and run the risk of making embarrassing errors. Well, do you think?
Yes.
God. So, that's what it's all about. They're always talking that if they had to have these EPA rules, that this would cost the energy businesses like the Koch brothers $20 billion to comply.
When they're worth.
Yeah. Well, so what?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
I mean, they're worth so much.
Yeah. It doesn't matter.
They don't care. They don't care about the air we breathe.
Yeah. So, hey, keep fighting, folks. This is the beginning of a new era of fight back. We are turning the class war against those that have initiated against us.
And the difference between us and those crazy beggars who said it's time for revolution is we're not condoning bring your guns to the rallies or any kind of nutbag things like this.
I mean, the protest in tens of thousands of people, up towards 100,000, maybe more.
In Madison.
No arrests, no guns. Nobody had any guns.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, no, I'm sorry. The teabaggers came and some of them had guns.
I'm sure they did.
Yeah.
They can't help themselves.
Yeah, I know. I know. So we're at the entrance to a new epoch, and we can all be part of it. We can make history. It's quite a challenge.
Yes, it is.
Aaron, thank you very much for answering the phone.
Thank you, Aaron.
Julene Jordan.
Yes.
Wonderful as always.
Thank you, Peter. You too.
And stay tuned. I'm going to be interviewing Cindy Estrada, who's one of the vice presidents of United Auto Workers.
We'll
continue this discussion, and we'll be back next week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
WRIF and Live Nation present the Riff's 40th Anniversary Concert. Stone Temple Pilots live. STP rocks the Motor City, April 20th at the Fillmore Detroit. Join the Riff as we celebrate 40 years of rocking Detroit with Stone Temple Pilots. Tickets for STP available now at all Ticketmaster outlets online at LiveNation.com. Plus, keep it on 101 WRIF to score your free tickets and more. WRIF's 40th Anniversary Concert with Stone Temple Pilots, April 20th, the Fillmore Detroit. From Live Nation and 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
I've got a question for all you business owners out there. How would you like to see customers coming through your door today, and the next day, and the day after that? Well, if you're looking to drive customers to your local Motor City business, I may just have the answer you've been looking for. MotorCityDailyDeal.com. It's a simple program that really works for local businesses. First things first, there are no upfront costs to be a part of the MotorCityDailyDeal.com program. It's a partnership with your success as the goal. Their marketing pros work with you to develop the perfect deal to bring customers right to your business. Then MotorCityDailyDeal.com uses the power of great Motor City radio stations like WRAF, social media, and an effective daily email sent to tens of thousands of consumers right here in the Motor City who are looking to try out new restaurants, bars, stores, golf courses, salons, spas, you name it. And did I mention that you get a check within 10 days of your successful deal running? Yeah, that's right. Cash in your pocket and customers in the door. MotorCityDailyDeal.com. Connecting local customers to local businesses is what it's all about at MotorCityDailyDeal.com.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now, Night Call is back. On 101 WRIF Detroit, here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Well, boy, you got to be a little brain dead if you're not looking at everything that's happening in the world. In fact, one of the slogans is Cairo to Madison. The times, they are a-changing. Almost has the feel of the 60s or the 1930s, that we are in an epoch of historical change. And the definitions of it are not really set yet, but they're beginning to. And joining me to help me talk about this is the president of the United Auto Workers, vice president of the United Auto Workers, Cindy Estrada. And she was elected UAW vice president on June 16th last year by delegates at the union's 35th Constitutional Convention in Detroit. Cindy Estrada is a longtime union organizer and a social activist. She's the first Latina elected to serve as a UAW vice president. It's a pleasure to work to welcome her to our studios here. Cindy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And in what I always say, full disclosure, I should say, I'm a longtime union member myself, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, And from 2000 to 2003, I was an employee of the UAW in their broadcast division, which they no longer have. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Yeah, I was.
Great.
So, you know, if you want an objective, you know, I don't buy that. Anyway, this so-called objectivity. There was an old song from the 1930s which said, "Which side are you on?" And it is, I think, coming to a point where we've got to really look at what is in the interests of our families, of our neighborhoods, of our communities. But I brought Cindy Estrada here not to listen to my speeches, but I wanted to find out. First, it's unusual. As you said, you're the first Latina, and also you're fairly youthful. Or you're youthful.
Oh, thank you.
Sorry. I will take away the fairly.
Take away the fairly.
And what does that signify? The fact that you're the first Latina, and you're usually, you know, you think that guys are going to be, it's going to be guys, and they're going to be in their 50s and 60s.
Well, I think it's clear that the labor movement is constantly changing. I think if you look out there in the workforce today, I mean, it's made up of all different kinds of people. And I think unions are better reflecting that, both young and old, and you know, different races, different ethnicities. And I'm an organizer, my background, almost 16 years in organizing. And so I come out of you know, organizing work. And I think for the UAW, it shows that one of the big changes that we've made is making organizing our focus. And I think taking a woman, a Latina woman who has organizing experience, and the membership electing her as vice president says a lot about the direction we're going.
And that's under the leadership of Bob King. And although I worked under both Steve Jokich and Ron Gettelfinger, Bob King has really taken the union in another direction. I interviewed him right after he was elected. And you've been with the union at least since 1995, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So what are, you know, the changes are significant, aren't they?
I think that it's the changes that are happening are also because of the time. So I think we had elements of all of this, you know, both under Steve Jokich, under Ron Gettelfinger, and, you know, and more so now under Bob, because the times are showing that we need to make our whole focus organizing. And I think that's always been one of our focuses in the UAW, but now even more so. And we have a whole executive board and membership that understands the urgency of that in these times.
Well, Cindy Estrada, the reason that I wanted to invite you here, at least was impelled by the fact that a week ago last Wednesday, that I was at a meeting at the UAW International Headquarters at Solidarity House in Detroit, and there was a meeting that had such a vibrancy to it, and a lot of young people, a lot of young organizers, and the enthusiasm there wasn't about, what didn't seem like it was coming from a social movement or a union that was fading away or was collapsing or anything like that, but it had the spirit that you associate with the early days of the union. And is that your feeling too?
No, that's definitely my feeling. I think we see what's happening across the country today. People are ready to fight back. People are starting to see how working people all need to come together and not be divided by different issues. It reminds me of an organizing campaign. You never win in an organizing campaign when workers are so pitted against each other that they take their focus off the real issues. And then when they do that, they can't, you know, they lose focus. That's what's happening today. People are starting to see what they have in common. And what they have in common is being working families and everyone wanting the same thing, which is to raise a family, to make a decent living, you know, and to be able to save some for when you retire. And I think people are saying, we want that. We need to come together. Now, how are we going to do it? And how it impacts not just here in the United States, but how everybody wants that globally.
Well, I want to talk about globally, too, because the meeting at the UAW that I attended, and you were there as well and spoke, it was about solidarity with Mexican workers who were facing some pretty strong opposition to their attempts to unionize. But let's save that for a little later in our conversation with Cindy Estrada, who's the UAW vice president. And up until Wisconsin, and everything that's happening in Madison and out in Columbus and Indianapolis, people were about to write the death certificate for the union movement. That, you know, 7% down, lower than it ever was. The UAW has less members than it ever, almost than it ever has, certainly since the 1950s. And everybody was counting the labor movement out. And it was like the Republicans have launched the final spike into the coffin of the union movement. But I don't know. Doesn't look that way.
I think first it was an error on sort of the right to count the labor movement out, because when you say you're counting the labor movement out, you're counting working families out. And I just don't think that's going to happen in this country. I think there is a plan by the right to destroy the image of the unions and really to destroy the image of working people, because that's what unions are made up of, people, not the leadership, not me, but of working families. And they started with the auto crisis and employee free choice, trying to make it look like the union was the one destroying companies, when in fact we know that wasn't the case. It was the economy, it was gas prices, it was bad management. And they're trying to do that now with public sector, to say that public sector workers are responsible for the problems that we have in the state because they have these huge wages and benefits, one that is not true, but that they're the problem. And that's just, you know, another way of saying that unions are the problem. I just find that really hard to digest and believe when I'm out with these workers every day who are working in our states and working on the behalf of citizens. For them to be vilified like that, I think is really sad. And I think people are tired of that.
Well, I think some of these right-wing commentators may have overplayed their hands. I know Rush Limbaugh called the organizers union thugs, and the workers that were organized into the public sector worker unions, called them freeloaders, which means, of course, who? Our teachers, our first responders, our janitors, our psychologists. I mean, everything, every kind of key component of our local and state governments.
I think that's so sad. I mean, I was sitting down with Department of Human Service workers who deal with child welfare. You know, those aren't freeloaders. Those are men and women who step up to the plate to do a job because they care about it, not because they want to freeload off the state. In fact, they make less than the private sector anyway when you account for education. But again, that's just the way of the right to paint this image that unions, you know, are a certain type of person, instead of really understanding when people form a union, it's made up of all kinds of people. You know, like we were talking at the beginning of the show. And I think that this gives us an opportunity. When you look at the people out in Wisconsin, you're right. It represents, you know, a broad spectrum of people. And I think they've overplayed their hand because the news is showing it now. These are working families. It's not a union thug or a union leader. And they're going to have a little bit harder time with me because, you know, I am a bit younger. Latina. Your audience can't see me, but I'm hardly a thug. And neither is the membership out there represented. In
you, I suspect you could still be tough when you're doing negotiations. So.
Yeah, and I don't think when they call us thugs, they're saying tough. I think tough is good. I think what they're saying is that, you know, we're not fair.
Well, one of the things, let's get into a little to perception. And what's sometimes on the phone and talk show that I do, people will say, well, you know, unions were good for my grandfather or for my father, and they were in the UAW, but now it's necessary for us all to make our own way. And the idea that unions are bureaucratic, that they take dues, a negative portrayal on the part of some people who you think, they're oftentimes in their family were the people that were the union and UAW particularly stalwarts. What when they say, well, it was good for another generation.
You know, a union is when people come together and they have a seat at the table and they sit across from management and they say, we want a voice in our wages and working conditions. To me, I think that never gets old, right? I think we always need to sit across the table and collaborate and how things are going to work out. And so that's what I would say to them. I mean, we have a choice. I can either let management make all the decisions that affect my life and my family's, or I could say, you know what, as a worker, I want to sit at the table and be part of that process. Not make all the decisions, but be part of a process, which I think we did with GM and Chrysler when workers and management came together and said, how are we going to solve these problems together? Then that's when management recognized that workers had input and value, they added value, and management adds value. And that's really what a union is doing, is sitting down and having those discussions and coming up with an agreement that's a win-win for everyone.
I wonder, sometimes I kid with a lot of my callers who are from downriver, and I say, you know, is it the water that it's going through too many toilets and you're getting to you guys down there? Oftentimes young guys that you would think would be the most interested in being organized into a union because they're making not very good wages, have bad benefits, and no pension or anything like that, and certainly no grievance procedure or anything like that, and they seem resentful against, for instance, a UAW worker or a Teamster or somebody like that that's making a good middle-class wage. And it's almost like the politics of resentment that I can't have that, so I want them to be come down to my level. I don't understand that,
though. You know, I do, because I think it's fear. I think, one, is people don't understand that a union – people think that when they form a union that someone from the outside is going to come in and direct their life in the same way that a company is. And really what it is those workers there making the decision and getting resources from the union to help them. And so it's them. They don't understand that, first of all, what a union is. And the second thing is, you know – that's what the right does so well. That's why CEOs in this country are making so much money and our wages have stayed the same, is because if you can get two groups of workers fighting against each other instead of saying, how can we work together, then what we're not going to focus on is the fact that we have a really messed up system and where corporations are getting huge tax breaks and we can't even pay for our groceries and send our kids to school. And so that's what I would say to them is look at how CEO pay has gone up and how working families' wages have stayed the same. And there's a problem because those working families are voting on behalf of their interests in the CEOs. And I think it's because, you know, they've done a great job in vilifying unions. And really what they're trying to do is vilify working people. And so I would, you know, it doesn't surprise me. And I think people are afraid, and so you need to organize to see how you work together instead of saying, I hope the day comes when people say, you know what, I want what that union worker has, that we all deserve that. We all deserve to know what we're going to get for the next few years of our life. We all deserve to have a pension. I mean, and today people are talking about how pensions, how you shouldn't have them. I mean, and I'm watching people retire with 401ks that aren't going to make it.
Yeah. My guest on the Peter Werbe Show is UAW Vice President Cindy Estrada. Cindy, when I had Bob King, the president of the UAW, on right after his election last year, he said that he certainly was interested in building the union movement, but he also said it was necessary to create a social movement. What could you, like, maybe expand on that some?
You know, I think that's, to me, that means that we're going back to our roots, and I think we've been this way for a long time, but it hasn't gotten out there, is we don't just fight on behalf of union workers. I mean, when we take on issues, it's about all working families. Because what union workers do lifts up the rest of non-union workers. So to me, a social movement is we start to see what we have in common. And that's what I'm excited about being part of the UAW under Bob's leadership, is how do we reach out to workers who aren't even in unions and show that there's a problem in our country when CEOs and companies and corporations are making these ridiculous profits and we still have people that can't make a living. I represent some places where companies want to pay workers $9 an hour while they're making record profits. Some of them taking $23 million out just this year in stock options, and they're telling me that the workers should only have $9 an hour.
Yeah,
that is crazy.
And I don't think everyone thinks that's a terrible wage, or I think it's a disgraceful wage.
I think if you asked anybody who's living on nine and trying to support a family, they would say it's a pretty terrible wage.
And I should make myself clear. I don't mean that the person making it is disgraceful. It's disgraceful that we live in the country that's the wealthiest in the world.
Right.
And people are paid that as part of the economy.
And it's not necessary.
No.
A corporation, the ones I deal with, could certainly pay a living wage and still make money for themselves and still be very wealthy. It would just be having to share more with working families.
Well, it's you know, it's all a matter of how it's the wealth is divvied up, actually.
That's
and,
right.
And if you're we workers are, you know, there's a lot of us, so that means the price goes down unless you're organized to say, hey,
that's right,
we want a little more. We have it particularly good compared to organizing in other parts of the world. Like Colombia, perhaps the worst, but also Mexico. And as I mentioned earlier, the meeting I was at Solidarity House, the UAW International Headquarters in Detroit, had a meeting there a couple of Wednesdays ago. And maybe you could just, rather than me explaining it, just tell us what the function of the meeting was and who was involved.
So what my responsibility, one of my responsibilities in the UAW is I'm the vice president over suppliers, so auto suppliers. And so the meeting was really about bringing our membership together to understand why it's important to support workers in Mexico who are trying to organize, and how really We have to raise wages up in Mexico so that the threat of taking our work there so they could pay lower wages. And then they also threaten the Mexican workers that they're going to take their work to China for lower wages. So how do we come together and help them organize? They have don't have real unions there. Basically, the unions are called they have protectionist unions, which means that they're really government-run unions who the corporations support. And what it means is that workers, you know, they can't negotiate for real wages or benefits or even be recognized. So we are working with them so that when, for example, a Johnson Controls worker, who we represent workers here in Mexico, when they're trying to fight for the right to have a seat at the table and organize so that we can work together and really push that company to recognize them. Because what happens there is they, you know, sometimes they get beat up and killed. It's much, much more difficult there to organize.
Indeed. And organizing seems to be the key. Is it becoming any easier, or is it still really hard? I know that the labor movement's main agenda for the Obama administration hasn't come to fruition. That is the card check proposal. But what are you facing as an organizer in your organizing department at the UAW?
Well, you know, I think it's still really difficult because coming out of the auto crisis and the employee free choice phase, what happened was the right really made people think that unions cause companies to leave because they become unproductive. And I don't think we've completely recovered from that. And of course, we know that's not true. And in fact, the union, again, and GM and Chrysler were responsible for helping turn that around. So it is still difficult because workers are afraid and they don't understand that the union's not a third party, that it's actually them in that facility. So we're still facing that. But I think, I think what's happening across the country, people are starting to see that a union's not a third party. It's the actual workers. And we're, you know, in the UAW, we're not going to have elections anymore with the NLRB because the whole process is unfair. It would be like having a political election here where, you know, one candidate gets all the time and all the money and all the resources and all the communication with citizens, and the other candidate doesn't. And that's what we face when we try and organize. The company gets all the time with the workers. They get to say whatever they want about the union, and we never get a chance to respond.
Yeah, and the elections have not gone well, have they?
Because of that. It goes well. We get anywhere from 60 to 80% support. But then when you actually go through the process of waiting to get the election, the company spends millions of dollars fighting those workers, making them think that the plant's going to close, that they're going to send their work overseas. You know, and not that they're going to do that because they make decisions based on the bottom line, not about whether or not someone has a union. But it's effective and it scares workers.
Sure. And they bring in sometimes firms that specialize in anti-union campaigns. So looking at what's happening as we are around the Midwest, in Wisconsin particularly, but also in Ohio and Indianapolis, disheartening? It must be.
It is, but it's not surprising because, you know, I knew during the auto crisis when I saw them take on the UAW then that they were going to – it just makes sense. They wanted to take on the private sector first, which was smaller at 6.9%, and that they had, if you want to take on organized labor and stop unions, then you need to take on public sector, which is at 36%. So and you see that happening in Wisconsin, right? The unions, the workers are saying, hey, we'll come to the table. We understand we got to help the state out. We'll take concessions. But the governor is still saying, nope, it's not enough unless you give up your right to collectively bargain. And so to me, I think that it's not about saving the state. It's about how do we destroy workers' ability to have a voice at the table. And I think people are going to fight back against that. That's a First Amendment right. And we believe in democracy in this country. And I think it's not only people are going to stand up against it, but I think that the rest of the public who doesn't understand unions are becoming organized on what a union is.
I think I saw a poll, 61% of the people supported the right of unions to have collective bargaining. And the state assembly in Wisconsin has just voted. The Senate still doesn't have a quorum, but the state assembly just voted to limit or get rid of collective bargaining rights. You know, this is an odd question. I just thought of this, and I don't even know if it's real answerable, but what would happen if the Republican Party and the right wing were successful and they were able to destroy all of our unions and there wasn't any more unions?
I mean, you have an example of that. I mean, when we used to control the auto industry, right, when we had the majority organized, then wages and benefits were at a certain level. When we lost that density and we had less workers and the transplants came in, you saw wages go down. For a long time, when they first came here, like the Toyotas and Hondas, they said that we're going to keep the wages at where the auto workers were, where we were bargaining. Today, we don't have as many auto workers, so now they're saying, you know what, we don't want the wages there anymore. We want to pay the state average manufacturing rate, which is, you know, substantially lower. You're talking about going down to like $12 an hour jobs. And so I think that's what's going to happen here. If workers aren't at the table making, representing their interests and keeping wages up, then I think that then employers are going to decide this is how much we want to pay. This is what your labor's worth. And I just think that's outrageous that it wouldn't be between workers and employers to talk about what's a fair wage. And so I think wages will go down, benefits will go down, and eventually we're going to have, you know, a lot of people then reorganizing because they're going to say, God, we really do need those unions. It is like before. You know, maybe not exactly like before, but pretty darn close.
Well, it could be that our choices will be, this will either be like the 1930s or like the 1920s when labor and working people really took hits when there was no guarantees of anything. There wasn't a weekend. There wasn't, all of those things that we now absolutely take for granted. Could go away. What is UAW priorities now in terms of organizing?
One of the things that we did is each vice president is over a sector or a couple sectors of organizing, and so mine is suppliers in the auto industry as well as the public sector workers. But our big priority is this fight right now that's happening in the states. It's for our survival, right? They're trying to get rid of unions because they know unions contribute to leveling the playing field and to making sure that things are policed. And so that's our major fight right now. But also organizing workers at the Toyotas and Hondas and Volkswagens of the world, we need to get back to the point where the majority of that industry is organized, where auto workers are having a seat at the table and not just a partial seat.
What about Michigan? Rick Snyder, the new governor, the self-described nerd, says he's not into confrontation, that he wants to deal in a compromised situation with employees. Do you have faith or confidence in him?
You know, I have hope. We did sit down and meet with him, Bob and I, and one of the things that he said is he wanted to do what happened at Ford, right? He wanted to have a labor management team where we could look at how do we create more efficiency in the government, and that he realized that it was the workers who were going to be able to tell him that. And so I'm looking forward to that and hoping that that happens. I'm very disappointed by the budget. I think that when we go after retirees and children, especially, I mean, what's happened in this country where we would take money away from education for children, where we all agree that they don't even have enough resources now, or that we would take someone who has a pension, who had a belief that this is what they were going to get and plan their life accordingly and tax them on that. I mean, I think something's gone really wrong.
Well, it's wrong, too, when you think about it, is that we have the wealthiest country in the world. In other words, the most accumulated wealth is owned here by individuals, corporations, financial institutions. If the city's broke, the state's broke, the country's broke, there is something wrong. And Cindy Estrada, I like your formulation about leveling the playing field. I think another term for it, a more formal one, is called democracy.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much for being my guest. And it's like I said, I guess it's up to everyone listening and everyone who is a working person and, you small business men and women as well to figure out, is this going to be the 20s or the 30s? And I mean, 30s had a lot of strife, but what it did is it created the basis for the middle class. And if that starts to erode, folks, we've got some problems, huh?
You know, and before we go, I would encourage everyone to look up graphs where it shows how we are similar to what was happening in the 20s and 30s when you look at wages. When you look at the top 5% and the rest of America, we have a problem.
You can go to UAW.org and find out more about the United Auto Workers. There'll also be a link on my site, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, PeterWerbe.com. Cindy Estrada is the vice president of the UAW, one of them. Thank you so much for being on my program.
Thank you.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Did you know that eating less than 1,000 calories a day can actually make your body gain weight instead of lose it? To lose weight, you have to feed your body right. Hi, I'm Steve Bostic, president of Right Size Smoothies. When I looked around for a weight loss solution that would work for me, I couldn't find one that fed my body right. So I decided to create my own. My weight loss smoothies are so effective, so powerful, that I'm going to let anyone who calls today try them for 2 full weeks. I'll even personally guarantee that you'll see the weight fall right off. To claim your 2-week trial, call now and receive free shipping and handling. The number is 1-800-398-4022. And now I've made my smoothies even better because I'm going to guarantee the first 100 callers a 2-week weight loss trial. I'll even include free shipping and handling plus my revolutionary blender bottle absolutely free. But you have to call 1-800-398-4022. That's 1-800-398-4022.
The following statement has been authorized by Credit Guard of America. A nonprofit national helpline has been established to assist members of the public struggling with credit card debt. If you owe $2,000 or more to the credit card companies and are seeking relief, you are invited to call the toll-free helpline now for free information. 1-800-748-6965. This service is provided by Credit Guard of America, a nonprofit organization. The free helpline offers programs that allow you to cut your payments by up to half of what you're currently paying and reduce your debt to much less than you owe. Call the toll-free helpline now for free information at 1-800-748-6965. Again, a nonprofit national helpline has been established to assist members of the public struggling with credit card debt of $2,000 or more. Members of the public wanting to learn how to get debt-free and stay debt-free are urged to call the national toll-free helpline now for free information and assistance at 1-800-748-6965. That's 1-800-748-6965.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, I don't know, this will sound like I'm 110 years old, but when I went to college, it really wasn't very expensive. I went to Michigan State, and then I went to Wayne State University in Detroit as well. And I didn't rack up any big debt or anything like that. It was actually college fees, dormitory fees, all of that was pretty manageable. I think almost all of you know that now college is very expensive, and many of you and many people in your family leave with debt, with a student loan debt. And I often wondered, how in the world can a middle-class family even afford one student, let alone two? But there's so much more to it. And in this time of these bubbles where there's crisis after crisis, here's one that went right below the radar, and that's the student loan scam. That's the title of a brand new book by Alan Michael Collins. And what is really incredible to me, and I am so anxious to find out about this, its subtitle is The Most Oppressive Debt in U.S. History and How We Can Fight Back. The Most Oppressive Debt in U.S. History. Get that. Well, Alan Michael Collins is the founder of the Political Action Committee, StudentLoanJustice.org, and he earned engineering degrees from the University of Southern California. He lives in University Place, Washington, where we're reaching him. He's appeared on 60 Minutes. He's written for lots of papers like the New York Times, the Baltimore Sun. He's quoted regularly in the New York Times, the Chicago Sun-Times, and the Washington Post. And let's welcome him to the Peter Werby Show. Alan Michael Collins, welcome to the broadcast.
Hello, Peter. Good to be with you.
Well, I bet you have a personal story as to why you got motivated, into this whole idea of this book and why the student loan scam is the most oppressive debt in U.S. history. That boggles the imagination. Give us a personal story to start with us and go from the micro to the macro.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I have degrees in engineering from U.S. I had originally borrowed about $38,000 to make it through graduate school, which, believe it or not, is less than average these days. So after graduation, I got a fairly good job at California Institute of Technology as a scientist, but I left that job shortly before September 11th, 2001. So I found myself sort of unemployed, underemployed for about a year and a half. Well, I requested from my lender, who just happened to be Sally Mae, what's known as a forbearance, which allows you to suspend payments on your loan for a period of time until you can get back on your feet financially. Well, instead of granting me the forbearance, they instead put my loan into default. And from that point on, it's just been a roller coaster of penalties and fees and escalations. You know, about 14 months after I had put in my request for this forbearance, my original, what had begun as an original $38,000 in loans, had skyrocketed to over $80,000.
And $80,000? You might as well have done better to have borrowed from the mob.
Oh, well, yeah, you're not kidding. And what really got me was I had been speaking to them. And I was like, you know, this is just really almost criminal what you're charging me on these fees. And I mean, you're really making me tempted to just file for bankruptcy. And I came to find out later that, in fact, student loans are non-dischargeable in bankruptcy. In fact, student loans are the only loan in U.S. history to be exempted from standard bankruptcy protections. And so at that point, I decided to do some research into the industry and see what I was dealing with here. And so I spent the next literally 3 years from what began as sort of a personal quest, doing research on the industry, and I came to find out enough to write a book about it, which is The Student Loan Scam. Not only are student loans the only loan in our nation's history to be exempted from standard bankruptcy protections, but other basic standard consumer protections that we take for granted with every other type of loan, credit cards, payday loans, they don't exist for student loans. So statutes of limitations don't exist for student loans. The ability to refinance the debt. There may be a lender out there willing to give a better deal on your student loan, but if you've already consolidated, then you are stuck with whatever lender you consolidated with for the life of the loan. Truth in lending requirements have been, again, congressionally legislated away for student loans and only for student loans. So in addition to all these consumer protections that were taken, Congress also gave the industry really draconian and, as you said, mafia-like collection powers for the collection of not only the debt. I mean, there's you know, everybody, when you borrow money, obviously you need to pay it back with interest. But it's these penalties and fees that just exploded, and Congress gave the industry powers to literally seize people's paychecks, their income tax returns, even their Social Security and their disability income, all without a court order. And typically, I mean, this is done full on a very large scale across the country. You know, the borrowers simply have no recourse. There's no negotiation available to the borrowers because all the standard consumer protections that I mentioned had been taken away.
Let me interrupt just for a second here.
Sure.
And ask, is this in part done because there was a low return on these student loans? I mean, because I have to tell you, in honesty, I know, I don't know how it ever resolved itself, but I know a number of people that said, oh, yeah, I owe $15,000. I'm never paying them back. I mean, an extraordinary number of people who would never say that about their house mortgage or their car payment or
right.
Something like that.
Yeah, the premise for sort of tweaking the bankruptcy protections and other protections initially was, yeah, these stories of, you know, students that would graduate from college and very promptly file for bankruptcy on their debt. And this was promulgated by the student loan industry and repeated over and over and over again in the media. And you know, Congress was quick to act and to take away these very basic consumer protections. In hindsight, however, it turned out that the actual story was far different. It turned out that when student loans were fully dischargeable, like every other type of loan, in bankruptcy, in fact, far less than 1% of federally guaranteed loans were discharged through bankruptcy. That's a much better percentage than other types of consumer debt.
And probably says a lot for my friends.
Yeah, you hung out with a bad group there, I think. But no, in fact, this was a crisis that, as one congressman at the time put it, it was a crisis that only existed in the minds of the student loan industry. And
why do they have so much clout? I mean, how are they able to such a stranglehold on Congress? Usually it's about contributions to a reelection or election funds.
Well, it's an interesting story. You know, the Congress created this entity called Sallie Mae back in 1972. This is a quasi-governmental agency, for lack of a better word, that was set up specifically to repurchase student loans from banks to make, you know, banks more, to make it more of a liquid market and encourage banks to lend. Well, and so obviously, you know, Sallie Mae, being a creature of Washington, D.C., had extraordinary influence on Congress. Well, in 1995, Sallie Mae privatized from the government and became a totally for-profit enterprise. But it inherited a lot of the clout that it had, you know, been set up with by the government initially. And then again, yes, as you said, they certainly wasted no pennies and spared no expense in, you know, lining the congressional coffers of the various candidates that sat on both House and Senate Education Committees and also the Finance Committee and almost every other committee you can think of that has even a remote connection to student loans. It's really quite frightening the amount of money that they have put into Congress.
It's big business. I mean, what's the size of it? What are we talking about? I'm sure it's in billions,
right?
Oh, it's
a huge business. You know, I'm not sure when you went to school, but student loans barely existed back in, you know, let's say the 70s and 60s. Today, as a nation, collectively, we owe about $600 billion in student loan debt.
Really?
Yeah, it's an astonishing number. It's almost
amazing.
The same size as what we owe as a nation for our credit card debt.
Yeah.
And it's been growing exponentially. And here's another point that I think is very important. And, you know, I'm speaking on behalf of the borrowers who have fallen victim to this predatory system that makes it more profitable for the industry when students fall behind. But actually, I am fighting the fight for not only the borrowers, but also people who never borrowed a dime to go to college, but yet are stuck paying the price of tuition.
And, wait a minute, how's that?
Well, the thing is, this lending industry has caused massive inflation within universities and colleges across the country. In fact, since Sallie Mae was created, the price of tuition has risen at about double the rate of inflation every single year. So today, you know, people that don't borrow, you know, they're paying $30,000-$40,000 for their kids to go to school, you know, private school for 1 year. And, you know, those costs are just astonishing.
Hey, I don't understand, actually, as I said in the introduction, how a middle-class family can send one, let alone two, kids to college. The prices are just extraordinary.
Yeah, I think at this point it's fair to say that the wheels have pretty much come off the wagon. The universities have abused the power that they had, and they raised the tuition far above what any reasonable you know, nonprofit enterprise like university should be allowed to raise them at. And not only that, the colleges have fallen prey to the student loan industry. They've become collusive with the industry. In fact, you know, I was on 60 Minutes a couple of years ago, and shortly after that aired, Attorney General Elliot Spitzer of New York, and then his successor Andrew Cuomo launched an investigation into relationships between universities and lenders, and it turned out that there was a vast network of collusion going on between the universities and the lenders, where university financial aid administrators were receiving kickbacks from the student loan companies. And not only the administrators, but the institutions as well. So it was a very dirty game of pool that the Attorney General uncovered.
It's a terrific. Let me just reintroduce you, Alan.
Sure.
It's an appropriate named book, The Student Loan Scam, The Most Oppressive Debt in U.S. History. And this will definitely keep you listening. And the other part of the subtitle is, and how we can fight back. And we'll get to that in just a few minutes with Alan Michael Collins. This is the Peter Werbe Show. And you can go to Alan's website, which is studentloanjustice.org, like if you're getting out of the car or something right now. Studentloanjustice.org. There'll also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. And so you have this situation, though, where people will call the financial aid staff of a university thinking they're going to get help because they want to get their kids in school. The universities want students there, want the children of the family. And but they're kind of they don't realize the full game that's going on, do they?
Well, you know, it's really funny you should mention. It turned out that in many instances when students made that phone call to the financial aid office, the person who picked up the phone on the other end was actually an employee of a student loan company. And so, you know, it was very hard to tell where the colleges left off and where the lenders began. And, you know, there's, since that time, there's been some legislation to do away with the most obvious of the transgressions. But even today, you know, we can only expect that there are some very cozy relationships going on. And, it certainly does not serve the interests of the student.
Hey, Ma, what happened to you? You said your $38,000 loan had ballooned with interest to $80,000. Has it stopped there? Do you still owe it?
Oh, no, no, no. $80,000 was only like shortly, maybe a little more than a year after they had put my loan into default. By 2005, the amount had escalated to well over $100,000. And this I should note, this is despite my best efforts to deal with whoever was holding my loan through that time period. I offered to repay the amount that I had originally borrowed, plus the interest that it accrued up until the time of default. So that includes every dollar that the federal government paid for my loan. It includes a boatload of profit for the lenders. And to this point, I've been declined at every step in the way.
So you still owe it?
Yes, that's right. I'm a debtor, just like everybody who will be reading my book, more than likely.
Well,
that's right.
Aren't they going to come after you? I mean, aren't they going to sue you and then garnish you your wages? And
well, you know, it's a funny thing. What happens with student loan debtors is the following. I mean, they largely either they pay a hugely increased cost, like double or triple the amount they borrowed, or if they refuse or are unable to pay the massively increased amount, for all intents and purposes, they're sort of forced off the grid. So,
what do you mean? What do you mean forced off the grid?
Well, they can't get a job for any length of time until, you know, either the Department of the Education or the student loan companies come and start garnishing, you know, 25% of their wages.
Have you tried to buy a home in the last few years since you've owed this?
I actually was able to buy a $70,000 home in 2004.
Because oftentimes before they'll grant a mortgage, they...
Well, I did. I wasn't able to go through a conventional bank. I had to get a private loan from a private, actually from a private citizen.
Okay.
So I was paying, 13% interest on this home mortgage for...
Alan, I'm telling you, I got to introduce you to some mafia guys here. You're going to get better rates for it all.
I'm sure the folks over there can do me a far better deal.
What did you say? I forgot again. Was it $600 billion in student loans outstanding?
That's right.
Yeah,
$600
okay.
billion.
So we're talking about these 800-pound gorillas. Well, there's three of them really in the room right now. One is all the money we're spending on the Iraq war and occupation really just now, and the Afghan war. The other one is the credit card debt. But here we have the student loan, as you call it, the name of your book, the student loan scam, lurking there as well, and as jobs begin to disappear, people are going to not be able to meet their obligation. This is has a real potential for being something that none of us have are even on our radar.
Yeah, you know, that's right, and I'm sorry to throw another log on the fire, but there is a very clear similarity between what happened in the home mortgage industry and what, frankly, has been happening in the student loan industry for years. There's an environment where you have this government guarantee standing behind the loan, and you have the private business community, the lending interests, basically gone wild, heaping as much debt as possible onto these borrowers for these assets. This also is accompanied by huge inflation, as we saw in the home mortgage industry, a very horrible record of oversight on the part of the Department of Education, I guess it would be housing and urban development in the case of the home mortgage industry. So the parallels are just straight down the line. The only difference, though, is that in the home mortgage industry, at the end of the day, the borrowers, you know, if worse comes to worse, well, you know, they can pack up, they can file for bankruptcy, and, you know, they can walk away and get a fresh start. And that's, you know, a horrible outcome, don't get me wrong. But compared to the student loan industry, that's a pretty good deal.
Mm-hmm.
In the student loan industry, not only is the misfortunate borrower stuck with, you know, the principal, which I could see maybe, but the loan typically will have exploded to double, triple, or often quadruple, or even more than what was originally borrowed. And so there simply are no options for student loan borrowers. And, you know, it sounds like it, if you don't have student loans, you wouldn't understand. But if you have student loans, particularly defaulted student loans, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
You're talking about 10 million people. You talk about that in your book, The Student Loan Scam, the most oppressive debt in U.S. history and how we can fight back. Alan Michael Collins is the author. He's my guest. You can go to studentloanjustice.org. And yeah, it's a bummer to owe money and all that, but I don't mean to toss it off like that, because you say in the book, one day at the age of 33, I soberly recognized that my hopes for marriage, children, and a home were much farther away from being realized than they had been when I was 29, solely because of my mushrooming student loan debt. And you talk to a lot of people from around the country whose lives have been disrupted or ruined, and even one who became a student loan refugee. Talk a little about yourself. Has any of this been resolved? And tell us about the student loan refugee as well.
Sure. And you know, the emotional state that high levels of inescapable debt can cause to a person are, you know, pretty extreme. I started Student Loan Justice in 2005 and have been, you know, collecting members and stories and so on since then. We've got over 4,000 people in our group now, and we have people who have literally fled the country. In fact, we've got between 2 and 3 dozen people who have fled the country solely as a result of their exploded defaulted student loan debt. We've got people who, you know, I mean, most of the members have suffered a lot of the same, emotional, feelings that I mentioned, in terms of, you know, either being a stress on an existing marriage or being, a preventative force for getting married and having a family and so on and so forth. And in fact, there's a recent study through the U.S. Public Interest Research Groups called Paying Back, Not Giving Back, and it details a lot of consequences that student loan debt is having on our nation as a whole. And among those are people are putting off marriage and children until much later ages as a result of this debt.
Let's do this, though, and I'm sorry to interrupt you from time to time, but I want to make sure that we get, because people would go, whoa, more bad news. This is bad news. The book is Student Loan Scam, the most oppressive debt in U.S. history. But then the second half of the subtitle, the book by Alan Michael Collins, is And How We Can Fight Back. So let's address that. It sounds like they've got you by the cojones.
Well, you know, they do and they don't. I mean, we have a very strong argument on our side. I mean, there is no other debt instrument, no other type of loan in the nation's history, federally guaranteed or not, to have all the consumer protections that I mentioned removed. Now, Congress did this, and Congress, frankly, shouldn't have done it. And people who are expert in this field and unbiased will acknowledge that there really was no premise for doing this in the first place. And we're seeing the human suffering, truly the human misery that's resulting from this lack of consumer protections. So it should be fairly easy for Congress to simply restore the consumer protections that it took away. You know, that's certainly, it takes a congressional action, but it's certainly within the realm of Congress's power to do. And so clearly, it is time for Congress to end this failed experiment, return standard consumer protections to student loans, and approach the problem from that basis.
Is it on the agenda? Do you have the ear of any congresspeople or senators?
Well, you know, we do. As a matter of fact, we were credited as being the inspiration for what's known as the Student Borrower Bill of Rights. This was created by Hillary Clinton in 2006 and was reintroduced again in 2007. Not only that, I would have to give high credit to Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois. He's been besides Senator Kennedy, I'd say Dick Durbin has been among the foremost fighters in Congress for students.
What's the impediment, though? We're talking now. You've heard
well,
that stuff,
you know,
two and three years back.
Student Borrower Bill of Rights basically languished. It didn't really go anywhere, and I don't think there was really any push behind it in the first place. It was It was more a piece of legislation that was meant to put it, you know, get it out there on the map. Well, Dick Durbin also introduced legislation that would have restored bankruptcy protections for private loans, as did his colleague Danny Davis, both senator and congressman from your neighboring state of Illinois. And those two bills, well, the first was sort of quietly killed, and certainly the lobbying freight train that is the student loan industry had a lot to do with that. Danny Davis's amendment, which was very similar to Dick Durbin's, was actually voted down in committee by – sorry, it was voted down on the floor of the House by the Blue Dog Democrats, which I frankly wasn't too impressed with.
Conservative
Democrats. But, you know, when they're taking money from banks – there's just, in my view, that's just wrong. I mean, if you're sitting on a finance committee or you're sitting on an education committee and you're taking money from student loan interests, that frankly is just wrong. But yet, you know, I guess the Blue Dogs apparently have no problem with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me say that unfortunately we're at the end of our interview. But fortunately, you can go to Alan Michael Collins's website. It's studentloanjustice.org. Alan Michael Collins, his last name is Colinge. The book is The Student Loan Scam, The Most Oppressive Debt in U.S. History and How We Can Fight Back. CNN Money, just a couple of months ago, said student loans have become the most profitable, uncompetitive, and oppressive type of debt in our nation's history. There's about 5 million federal student loans currently in default. This could be the next bubble to burst. I advise anyone who is in this situation, who is thinking about ever going to college, who has kids that may go to college, get this book, The Student Loan Scam, The Most Oppressive Debt in U.S. History and How We Can Fight Back by Alan Michael Collins. There'll be a link on my website, peterwerby.com. Thank you so much for being on The Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter. Great to be with you.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Rip Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Why do we go through so much hassle for our morning coffee? We make it, wait in line for it, fuss with cream and sugar. There has to be a faster and easier way to shake the morning buzz. There is. 5-Hour Energy. It's ready right now. No making, waiting, or fussing required. And it really works. Just open it up, knock it back, you're done in seconds. Now that's fast and easy. 5-Hour Energy. The no-wait, no-hassle way to a great morning. Try it today.
Individual results may vary. See 5hourenergy.com for more details.
River Point Wellness Center.
Hi, I need to cancel my appointment.
And what were you having done?
I was having a treatment on my spider veins.
Okay, and can I ask why you're canceling?
Well, I found this product that really works.
Can I ask what product?
Oh, sure. It's Vinacura.
If you have frustrating spider or varicose veins, you don't have to get a treatment. Just get to your phone. For a risk-free trial of Vinacura, call 1-800-440-5589. All natural Vinacura contains a clinically proven ingredient that visibly erases spider and varicose veins, even if you've had them for years. It even helps alleviate discomfort. The results are so impressive, people who've tried it say it's life-changing. Find out how you can try Vinacura free for 30 days and watch as your spider and varicose veins disappear from view faster than you thought possible. Call now for your risk-free trial of Vinacura. But hurry, when this offer's gone, it's gone. For your risk-free trial, call 1-800-440-5589. 1-800-440-5589.
101-101-WRIF.
The Riff. Hey, this is Lawrence from Metallica.
The Riff.
Hello, this is Flea from Red Hot Chili Peppers.
The Riff.
Hello, this is Brian Johnson of AC/DC.
You're listening to Detroit's home of rock and roll, WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
Monthly payment calculation assumes 5% down at 7% APR over 30 years.
If you just bought a house and paid more than $70,000, you're going to want to change the station. Because we're about to tell everyone listening how to buy a house for as low as $70,000. So if you don't want to hear about these incredible deals, please change the station now. Imagine finding a great three-bedroom, one-bath home for $69,300. That's $440 a month. To learn how to get a free list of foreclosures, call 1-800-226-0775 now. CRN is offering rebates of up to $1,000 in cash. And if you call right now, you can find out how to get up to an extra $2,500 on top of that. So call in the next 30 minutes for your free foreclosure list. Again, to learn how to get a free list of foreclosures that may be available in your area, call CRN at 1-800-226-0775. That's 1-800-226-0775. 1-800-226-0775.
WRIF and Live Nation present the Riff's 40th Anniversary Concert. Stone Temple Pilots live. STP rocks the Motor City, April 20th at the Fillmore Detroit. Join the Riff as we celebrate 40 years of rockin' Detroit with Stone Temple Pilots. Tickets for STP available now at all Ticketmaster outlets, online at LiveNation.com. Plus, keep it on 101WRIF to score your free tickets and more. WRIF's 40th Anniversary Concert with Stone Temple Pilots, April 20th, the Fillmore Detroit. From Live Nation and 101WRIF, everything that rocks. Back to the rock.
Your mommy told us you like to listen to music.
On 101WRIF, everything that rocks.
She likes to shake her ass. She tries to.